You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LP 106.9, Salida, Colorado. And this evening on Truth Quest, we have Dr. Tim Ball, and he's back again. He's got always got a lot of great information, and tonight we're going to cover a couple of issues on water that we really haven't had a chance to get into. But I want to, for those who are not familiar with Dr. Ball, I would like to state that he is he's had a significant career here with stemming for quite a number of years, but he's been an instructor, a lecturer, professor at University of Winnipeg, environmentalist, public speaker, consultant, author, columnist, and he has won many special academic or professional honors. Professional activities outside the university, he's been a member of the Manitoba Water Commission for almost 16 years, back in from 1980 to 96, and president of the Social Science Teachers Association, the Manitoba Social Science Teachers Journal he was editor for, board member of the Forks Development Heritage Advisory Board, board member of Urban Ideas Center, Western Canada Pictorial Index, the City of Winnipeg's Advisory Committee on Hazardous Waste, technical advisor to the Canadian Cattlemen's Association, and many other significant things that he's been involved with, but he's written a number of publications. And is there anything you have to add to that, Dr. Ball?
No, I think that's a fair list. I'm particularly proud of the things because I was one of the few professors that got involved in the whole education process from K to 12, because it's a continuum, and unfortunately it becomes too compartmentalized that the people at the top never go and find out what's going on at the bottom, and I wanted to deal with that because I thought the students I was getting were a product of that, and if I didn't know what they were getting and where they were coming from, I couldn't effectively teach them. So that's why I was so involved in that.
Okay, before I get any further, I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I also want to state that all of the programs on TruthQuest are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And if there's any, and if you have any questions, you can also email the station at khen.dj@gmail.com. And Dr. Ball, there's a number of things. I've had you on a number of times with Dr. Carlstrom, and we've covered a lot of climate change issues, but there seems to me that there's looming in the background around all of this climate change, there is some other issues that are waiting to come forth, because they're talking about the carbon footprint, and now we've got something called a water footprint, and then we've got something called a nitrogen footprint. And you can Google these on the internet and find out they're really quite involved. And I'm going to let you take it from here.
Well, okay. What's going on here, of course, is that this is all part of the whole environmental movement of becoming aware of the environment. And then behind all of that, unfortunately, is a political agenda that overpopulation, which was the agenda of the Club of Rome, starts with Malthus, of course, the increasing the population, outgrowing the food supply. But this is an issue that's been at the center of academia for a long, long time. But it reached a peak with the Club of Rome, where the overpopulation issue, and particularly an industrialized or developed population, was making demands on the resources, and then also having an impact, a very negative impact on the environment. And it's become compartmentalized a little bit. The climate, the global warming issue was part of that, the climate issue. But then out of that, of course, came the carbon footprint. And that's an illustration of part of the difficulty, because It's not really carbon they're talking about. It's CO2. Carbon is a solid, actual particles, but the CO2 is a gas, and they use them interchangeably incorrectly. But the idea of the carbon footprint, of course, was the idea of the amount of impact that a footprint of an individual living on the planet had. How much CO2 are they using, and what effect would that have in the total picture? And it's been expanded. The idea of the footprint, of course, actually been around for a little while. I mean, people talked about the footprint of your computer on your desk. How much space did it occupy of the desktop? And so that's the concept of it. But now it's expanded into the nitrogen footprint, and this is the idea that nitrogen is a very, very important fertilizer and chemical in agriculture. And the argument is that because we're using so much of it to increase the yields on our crops, that it is having a negative impact on water bodies and other places. So it's become a new measure of the impact of humans. And of course, it's always a negative impact. That's the underlying theme of all of these things, that somehow we're not supposed to be on the planet at all, and therefore, if we could just, some of them think if we could just get rid of all the people on the planet, it'd be a great place to live. But it's attempts to measure the effect of individuals and then expand that into the total population, and it's all part, as I say, of the whole overpopulation issue and the effect that humans are having. And then attempts, of course, to limit or control the population. And then within that also the argument that because some countries and groups have supposedly advanced ahead of others, and that's defined as the developed nations and the underdeveloped nations, that there's got to be some, they've done that at the expense of these underdeveloped nations, therefore there's got to be some equalization. And it's this sort of a socialization of the whole process. So the Kyoto, for example, was to punish those developed nations for their sin of producing CO2. They would pay, and that money would then go to the developing nations to compensate them and help them deal with the supposed climate change impacts that the developed nations had created. So there's all of these ideas all interlink, and as I said, they're an integral part of the, in a way, exploitation of environmentalism, and it's a shame because, of course, what's happening is that it's being so badly misused, and so many scares with it, so much misinformation, and as this is exposed, more and more people are saying, we don't believe you anymore, and so that's the situation we're at. The water issue, of course, the next major issue. Many years ago, I said the two issues for the 21st century would be water as a resource and then magnetism as an energy force. And we've seen the water issue just developing and growing. Interestingly enough, the UN had an international decade of water back in the 70s, and it was the idea to get clean drinking water to everybody on the planet. And it would reduce infant mortality and the waterborne disease and all the other things. And that sort of came and went. But the water issue is coming back because, of course, it's the most important resource and potentially being polluted and being monopolized by the power rich and the powerful. So the water issue is coming back again. And It will increase in intensity as the climate issue fades, as the evidence that the humans are, the CO2 is not the cause of climate change.
Now, when you get talking about this water issue, Before I get any further, though, I do want to mention that you do have a website. It's drtimball.com, and so this gets into some of the various topics that you cover, and that you have written a book called Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory.
Yes.
And if you want to mention a little bit on that, but then I'll get into my question after that.
Sure. And I appreciate the opportunity of you mentioning it. One of the things that bothers me in today's world is that all of the talk programs are, if somebody's published a book and then they get on the television or the radio, they do the circuit, as I call it. And of course, the other thing that's really disturbing is somehow you have credibility because you've written a book. Your book can be absolute nonsense, but that's sort of not an issue anymore. But the book, the Slaying the Sky Dragon, came about, and a group approached me and asked me if I would be involved in it. And it speaks to what I think is a very, very important thing for people to understand, and that is that climate, and we've talked about it on the program with Eric and yourself, but climate is a generalist discipline. It's made up of so many different things that create the climate and can cause climate change. And of course, when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which made itself the official climate experts agency, you had individual specialists all supposedly working together, and they were using various specialist areas of research, but they were misusing them. I mean, the classic example of it is the hockey stick, which was this graph that showed virtually no temperature change for almost 1,000 years and then a sudden upturn in the 20th century. And it was a statistician, a specialist in a particular area of statistics, that is, at looking at graphs and identifying false claims, particularly in the mining industry. And he looked at the graph, and he knew exactly how it had been misused and falsely created. And it was, of course, Steve McIntyre. And so out of that idea, with this group, they were physicists and radiation experts and so on. So what I did was I wrote the introduction to the book talking about this idea that it's almost a gestaltist thing in psychology, that is, the sum of the parts are greater than the whole. So I wrote about climate as a generalist discipline, about how the climate models and the IPCC were created. And then we got these experts in very specialized areas to look at one part of what they had done. And, of course, a lot of this has gone into their computer models. And the minute these experts in one area started looking at how their particular area of specialization had been used, they said, this is terrible. You know, nobody in the area, in the field, must or could have looked at this, or it would never have got through. And so what it's doing is showing that in order to create this patchwork of reports that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have done, they misused so many areas of science. And now it's created some controversy, of course, even amongst the skeptics, because a lot of the skeptics, just like the people that are pushing the global warming due to humans thing, a lot of the skeptics don't fully understand climate and climate science. And so, of course, a lot of them are very upset. And so as we start to take the whole corrupted climate science apart, what had divided into two simple groups, that is, the people that were saying human CO2 was causing warming and the others that weren't, who became called skeptics. But there are disagreements amongst the skeptics on a lot of issues, and of course it creates difficulties because people are much more comfortable in groups. If we're a large group, and we saw the consensus argument, you know, it must be right because all of us agree. But one of the things that's been disturbing, not just in climate science, but what I've observed in society in general, is this this approach or attitude that if you're not with me, you must be against me.
Where have I heard that term before?
Yeah. Well, it's very divisive. It's very polarizing, and it's going on everywhere. and it's really very unhealthy. And it's sort of like I was at a conference once where people were arguing, and it got quite nasty. And the chairman simply said, "Gentlemen, we're here to disagree, not be disagreeable." And and of course, there's a very nasty edge that has taken over so much of both scientific and political and public discourse in today's world. And
don't you often find that when you have a situation where it isn't about, I mean, I'm finding that the personality has come into this so much in so many avenues, and when you have that personality come in and take over the logic and the actual elements of the discourse, it does graduate over into name calling and childish, sometimes childish or inappropriate behavior. And when I'm looking at some of the reviews just on various books or whatever, it's like they're ridiculing the person instead of really trying to just state that, you know, they didn't agree with them.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, there's two sides to that. One part of it is, of course, that if you start losing a discussion or a debate, it's a very human tendency to resort to what the philosophers call the ad hominem attack. That is, you start attacking the person rather than attacking the ideas. And, of course, this is something that I've experienced a great deal of. And you say to people, no, let's get back and talk about the issues. And, of course, they don't want to do that because they know they're losing the debate on that. And so that's part of it. The other part of it, when you talk about personalities, we're in a society of the personality, of the you know, the figurehead and the powerful people. More so, I mean, it's always been that way to in an extent. It's a function of human societies and so on. But with the television and you know, the cult of the personality has become much more a factor in today's society. And I think it was somebody once said that one of the problems with democracy is that it's a perfect breeding ground for psychopaths. And so that, you know, somebody that can get up there and lie with a straight face, and even if they're exposed in the lie, not be embarrassed or ashamed or you know, say, okay, you got me, or I'm wrong, and they just keep walking through. And there's such a single focus to the way they do things. And so it's a combination of these things that in an age of the Internet and television and instant communications. And of course, the other side of it, the Canadian philosopher Marshall McLuhan, and, you know, he was analyzing a lot of this stuff back in the 60s and the 70s. I mean, he was the one that created the term global village, that something happens and it's around the world instantly and everybody knows about it. But the other phrase that he's famous for is the medium is the message. And it's how the stuff is brought to us by the Internet or by television or by YouTube that determines what we see and how we see it. Now, to give you an example of what I'm talking about here, Melody, is that a television stations would call me say, well, we want to do a story on this particular topic, and you give us some ideas. And I would give them ideas, and quite often they'll come back and say, well, that was a good idea, but it doesn't lend itself to television. And of course, you see it also in how do you show pollution on the TV screen? And the answer is all you could do is get a smokestack with something coming out the top of it. Now, nowadays, it's 99% water vapor and quite harmless, but nonetheless, it conveys the message of pollution. And of course, is a totally distorted thing. So what we're seeing here is a shift. Now, these kinds of shifts have gone on throughout history. I mean, one of the significant ones was the value of the spoken word back in Greek times, and then the printed word started to come in and become more important. And my comment earlier in the program where I said, you know, you publish a book and you're on a radio or television, and somehow because you publish the book, it gives you all kinds of credibility. We're just sort of coming to the end of that phase.
You know, just to bring up that, just really brought to mind, is I was wondering why there's been so many of these politicians that, you know, some of them, when you look into the background, is quite dubious, but they all come out with a book, and it's just like, that's just standard, it seems like. And it seemed like when there was an election going on, and they were counting over 1,000 books in that one election alone, just because
exactly.
of that.
Exactly. And it gives you, not only does it give you instant credibility, but it also gets you on all the chat shows, as the English call them. You know, you're on with Fox, and you're on with ABC in the morning and all the rest of it. I mean, all you're doing is you're flogging your book and your idea, but somehow it gives you instant credibility, and that's what it's all about. Of course, the interesting thing about that, Melody, on another side, is that it pays to read what these people are saying, but read it very carefully, because invariably they're telling you what they plan to do if they get in power. I mean, if you go and read what Obama wrote before he got into office, or the classic one in history, of course, is Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, and he told you exactly what he planned to do if he got in power. What did we do? We banned the book. I mean, if you ever want a case against banning books, there it is. And you can go through history and find out these people sit down and write what their basic ideas. And by the way, many times, a lot of what their careers are going to be about is in their doctoral theses and things like this. The sort of theme of their research in academia. And we'll talk about a couple of examples of that later on when we get around to the water issue.
Before I forget, would those doctoral theses, and this is coming from somebody that has no experience or any background in from this aspect, but when they do those doctorals, what is the purpose in having them do those, other than, you know, getting through their, you know, their PhD or whatever? There's a purpose behind that. What?
Okay, well, of course, you know, one of the problems with academia, the way it's become, is a lot of students go to the university and they get a lecture from the dean about, you know, you're not here for job training, but they never tell them what they are there for. And so your question speaks to that. So why are you doing the PhD? What's the purpose of it? And I mean, I can approach it from the other end when somebody says to me, oh, you know, I know a guy with a PhD in philosophy and he's driving cab. And my answer is, that's where he deserves to be. If he hasn't thought it through better and understood what the PhD was trying to, the skills it was trying to provide him with, or her, then that's where they deserve to end up. And so people go through these procedures, get these pieces of paper, but never really understand what it's teaching them or what the value of it is.
Well, I guess where I was going with is a little bit, and this is coming from somebody that doesn't have a background in it, but looking at it going, is that used by the university as a launching, or by the person as a launching point between the two of them? Since so often universities are sponsored via corporate governmental entities, if you're not working within that framework, does that have a major effect, or do you even have a clue as to that, what I'm saying here?
Well, we've evolved into basically two types, and we'll do it at the PhD level. We've evolved into two types. There are those that are specific job training. And certainly, you know, it's not necessarily a PhD, but certainly a medicine or law is specific job training in a specialist area. But the PhD beyond that is the ticket. And it always, one of the things I used to talk to my students about, because I would hold noon hour sessions where we talk about what the degree was about, what they were learning, what good did it do them. But, you know, if you think about it, if there's an ad in the paper on Saturday for a job with, and what you require is a PhD in chemistry, and you go down on Monday morning and there's five people lined up outside the door, well, what's the one thing you know about those five people? And the answer is they've all got a PhD in chemistry. But they tend not to think about it like that, and they tend not to realize that at that point, it's no longer of any value. So if they go into the room and the interviewer says, well, what can you do? Well, I've got a PhD in chemistry. Well, the interviewer is saying, well, I know that, you idiot. You wouldn't be outside the door if you didn't. So it becomes a sort of a ticket, a filtering process. But going up to the PhD level is where we fail to teach people what the purpose of it is. Now, for example, if you're doing a general degree, whether it's arts or even in sciences, you're really not learning what's going on in the world or what's directly applicable to the world. What you're learning is management skills. I mean, I don't care whether you're doing...
But by which side of the fence?
Sorry?
But which side of the fence? I mean, is that those letters behind your name mean that you are now being... They can manage you as much as you're learning management skills?
Well, it's you're learning management. I think techniques is a better term.
Okay.
And this, by the way, is why students go out with, a BA in history, and they find nobody wants to hire them. Well, nobody hires managers without experience. And what I always told my students to do was, look, get your degree, but also go and get a diploma in something, a technical skill, because that'll get you the job. The degree will get you, will advance you once you're in the job, because now you're moving up to management level and you need those management skills. So, as I say, I don't care whether you're doing history or political science or whatever it is. What do you do? You're given assignments to write research papers or term papers or essays, and what do you do in those? You identify a problem. You go into the library or whatever you need to do, or even in the lab, and you come up with the data, and then you write an analysis and a solution to the problem. Well, that's what a management person does. They sit in the office until some problem develops, and then they have to identify the problem, collect the data to solve it, and then presumably solve the problem. And so now when you get to the PhD level, of course, what you're doing, and I learned this from my doctoral supervisor because I spent, months working on it, and I sent it to him, and he said, hey, great doctoral thesis, but so what? and I said, what do you mean, so what? And he said, well, draw some conclusions. And I said, well, I don't know enough to draw conclusions. And he said, well, who else is going to do it? You're the only person that's been looking at this area. You're now the world expert in this particular area, right? And so that's why I'm saying if you've got a PhD in philosophy and you're driving a cab, that's what you deserve to be doing. Because you have to think through, how am I going to use this PhD? What is it teaching me? What skills? And you're effectively carving out your own job. Now, of course, most of the time it takes you right back into academia. So you're now a specialist in a certain area, and you're hired into a department to teach in that particular area. And so you're really at the frontiers of the research. But as I said, very, very few universities that I know of sit the students down and explain what the thesis is. And for most students, unfortunately, in today's world, particularly if they're just going through for a general degree, it's really just grades 13, 14, and 15. And as I like to argue, for most students, it's just a socially acceptable form of unemployment. And because... as it is now, if all the students came straight out of high school onto the job market simply couldn't absorb them. So you need this filtering system, and you're teaching them some extra things, which is fine. But if you don't tell them what that is teaching you or how it's used and what the purpose of it is, it really becomes meaningless.
Okay, and, to kind of tie this in the direction where I was trying to go with it, is you get all these letters behind your name,
yep.
And some of them become professional students because it may tie in exactly where you're coming from. Is it?
Yep.
And,
oh, exactly.
And yet, when I yep. get around some of these educated people, it's so, you know, if you don't have those letters behind your name, you don't have any credibility. Go ahead.
Oh, I agree with you, but we've allowed them to do that. I mean, one of the problems I have is that society has allowed the academics to define IQ, but they define it in a very, very narrow way. And there are a lot of skills in society. Just to give you a social example, the movie Crocodile Dundee was a real important moral and intellectual message in it. And the message was that here's some guy from the outback of Australia that could survive very well in New York, but he took somebody from New York to Australia and they die in a minute. And who's calling who primitive?
Right.
So, in other words, the skill sets that you need are variable and all have application. But we've allowed the academics to define intelligence in a very narrow way. And, I mean, I joke about it in another context in that I point out that there's not a university in the world that teaches a half course or gives a half credit in common sense. And because I then rub salt, as is my wont, by saying if there was, they'd have to bring somebody from outside to teach it. And one of the things that I fought for, you know, because of my awareness that education is a continuum from K through 12 and so on, is I think that all academics should have to serve as part of their contract, serve on commissions, in committees in society where they can provide theoretical explanations of what's going on to the lay people, if you want. But then they are also involved in the real-world decisions that put the theory, which is all very nice in theory, but in practice doesn't work. It gives them a better perspective. And this is one of the things I fought desperately to do. That's why I served on the Manitoba Water Commission, because I taught a course in water resources, but it wasn't until I was on that water commission looking at conflict over water and management of water that I think it made me a far better professor. And I know the students appreciated the fact that I could bring real-world situations in. And I think that it would make academia much more relevant than it is in today's world.
So you're saying that they have a tendency to be isolated, particularly if they stay in the academic arena as opposed to out there in real-world application?
Yeah, it's the ivory tower, of course, is the syndrome that everybody knows about. But what you've got now are ivory towers within the ivory tower.
Right.
And I'm no great fan of his because he doesn't say very much intelligent very often. But Prince Philip once said that universities are the only truly incestuous systems that we have in our society, that everybody that's in them is a product of them. And they make sure that they keep it that way because that all of the deans and presidents are promoted from the academic world. So if you bring somebody from outside and they see what's going on, they can't believe how these people operate. It's an incredible system.
Yeah, but it's the criteria. I mean, if you have to have a degree to get in there, then it's going to go without saying.
Exactly. And think about here's just one contradiction in it. Nowadays, you basically got to have a PhD to get into a university position. And yet, for a lot of places, I mean, Eric would support this, a lot of places, much of your time is taken up with teaching. You're not required to have 1 minute's training in how to teach. I mean, the only people I know of that are less qualified for what they're doing are secretaries in the government or cabinet ministers, you know. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. And if you think about it, a PhD, a research degree, is earned by squirreling yourself away, focusing on one very narrow thing and really not communicating with the world. But being a good teacher is almost the opposite. You need to be an extrovert and somebody that can communicate and express things. I mean, everything you ever hear about Einstein was that he was just the world's worst teacher. But these are all of the contradictions in these universities, which I have called medieval institutions, that are being dragged kicking and screaming into the 18th century.
Well, I don't know where I want to go with this, other than the fact that formulate the fact that what I'm seeing, just as an outsider who's gotten the privilege of setting in on some discussions of people that have really looked at some of these issues like global warming and the like, carbon footprint. Is to see that my first impression that I'm seeing is, okay, I've got to wade through some of the personality things and that goes on behind the scene that the public never sees.
Right.
And then I'm going, this is spooky, because I ran into it recently when I did an interview with Dr. Judy Wood. The sad part about it is she's asking questions, but she's being condemned for someone else's conclusions from those questions, when she's just ultimately, you know, there's some science in there that may be questionable, but that isn't the crux of the problem. The problem is she's not being allowed to ask the questions without being vilified.
Oh, exactly. Well, it's been written about and known for a long, long time. I mean, Byron had his comments about universities and the politics in university, and I'm going to tell you this from my experience, having been in the military, where there was the politics of a kind. I've worked in government, I've worked in private industry, and I've been in academia. And I've got to tell you, the politics in academia are the most vicious and the worst that there are.
Right.
And basically what it comes down to is that in the academic world, they essentially control it all within, as I said to you before. I mean, the universities are run by the senates, which are made up by the faculty. They do their own internal promotion and tenure granting and everything else. And there's two ways to get ahead. One, you can pull yourself up, and the other way is to push the other person down. But it's a lot easier to push other people down. But the stories are legend and in novels. I mean, C.P. Snow wrote about the politics of Cambridge, and many, many people have written about how nasty the politics are. In fact, I have jokingly said I took early retirement from the university, and I jokingly said that I had to retire because there was so much scar tissue on my back there was nowhere to put a knife anymore. And
it's amazing that we have any kind of inventions or things that are useful in our lives if it depended upon the politics and what comes out of what goes on behind the scenes among the academic and scientific community, let alone the corporate.
Well, no, but you see, this is the interesting thing. When you start to look at innovation and invention, very, very little of it comes out of the academic world. Virtually all of it comes out of the business world or somebody working in their basement.
Right.
I mean, Edison had his own lab. And it's interesting when you look at the U.S., for example, the great corporations that staggered badly was because, for example, IBM had a huge research and development division. Bell had a huge area. All of these had very large research and development divisions, and for some reason, partly financial, they started to close them and shut them down. Well, that was the source of their inventions and advance and control of the industry. But very, very little comes out of the academic world. And in fact, sadly, what comes out of the academic world are things that have caused all kinds of destruction, because they work very nicely in theory, but when you go to put them into practice, they simply don't work. And there are so many examples that I can give you of this.
Okay, now to bring that full circle back then to where, when we get back to the water footprint and the nitrogen, the reason why I felt like kind of going in this arena was kind of pertinent is to find out that those that are telling us about what, how to run our lives and how we're going to live our lives is coming from some really flawed areas, as far as I can tell.
And
would you get the personalities and the fragment of science and the propaganda and the government and agendas, it's spooky.
Right, and you know what's even worse about it, of course, is that so many of the once you get into a university, and particularly if you get tenured position, and nowadays if you're bringing in large amounts of funding, you know, you're not really accountable to anybody. You can throw out all these ideas, and you can cause all this damage. But you're still going to keep your paycheck coming in. You're still going to have a nice office to go to. You're still going to have lab or research students doing your marking, graduate students doing your classrooms and doing your marking and everything else. And said you're simply not accountable to anybody. I'll give you an example of when you get an academic going into the real world. I mean, to me, Alan Greenspan was a good example of it. Maybe one of the most I've always looked for comments that summarize a whole patterns of history and time. I think that one of the ones I liked at the end of the 20th century was Alan Shepard, who was launched into space, and they said, "What were you thinking about as you went up on that first rocket?" And he said, "All I could think about was that every part was made by the lowest bidder." You know, and to me, but when, you know, when Alan, when Greenspan appeared before with the Waxman Markey's committee, and they said, well, you know, what happened? What caused this economic collapse, which of course led to the stimulus bills and all the rest of it, and the takeover of the banks on? And he just very quietly and straight faced, never even batted an eye, just said, "Oh, my computer model was wrong." And one of the senators said, "Well, how long have you been using this model?" He said, "Oh, 40 years. Think about that. That's frightening. And the same thing's going on, by the way, with these computer models that they're using in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Computer models are throughout all aspects of everything. You get it into the medical arena. You get it into any arena. They're using computer models.
Well, there's a couple of things. One, of course, is because it can handle a lot more data. Its ability to manipulate data. But if your understanding of the mechanisms and the theories are not good. And the other thing is that a model is always an average. And so it's one of those things sort of where it fits everything but doesn't fit anything because it's an average. And the models, to me, have become the bane of our society. And we do it. It started, you might remember, before your time, but there was a thing back in the 50s and 60s about, you had to be a certain height and weight, otherwise you were not healthy. Well, it was a model created by an insurance company. And it
doesn't surprise me at all.
No. You know, and so you get this, all of these sort of theoretical ideas in the academic world, and there's no problem. If you want to play with your models in the university, that's fine. I have no difficulty with that. There's a scientific responsibility. There's an academic responsibility that you're, you know, transparent in what you're doing and can justify what you're doing in terms of logic. But when you go public and say, no, my model works and the predictions of it are accurate and you've got to set your whole society around that, there's another whole set of responsibilities that kick in. And unfortunately, these people are not being held accountable to that. Now, there's another whole side to this argument or this issue, Melody, and that is a lot of people look for academics who will give them intellectual justification for what they're doing. I mean, the classic one is, of course, you know, Hitler was looking for an excuse to invade surrounding lands, and there was a German geographer by the name of Friedrich Ratzel who wrote a book called Anthropogeography. This is at the end of the 19th century. And basically what he argued, it's a form of social Darwinism. He said that nations are like, they're an organism. A nation is an organism. And it will grow like any organism. And that the stronger organisms will grow at the expense of the weaker organisms. which is just pure social Darwinism applied to nation states. And of course, Hitler, and he used the term Lebensraum, which is living space. Well, of course, Hitler grabbed on this and said, "Oh, you know, here we have this is the academic justification for what I want to do. I want to invade Poland and the Sudetenland and so on." And then a Swedish academic by the name of Jelen, that's spelled K-J-E-L-L-E-N, he said, "Well, yeah, not only do the weaker or the more powerful nations." It's a natural process for them to expand at the expense of the weaker ones, but they can use force to do it. So, of course, what Hitler gets the old blitzkrieg going, and he's got the academic justification for his actions. And so often that's what's going on in the world, that you go and get the academics that will provide you with the supposed intellectual justification. But most of the time, it's purely theoretical, doesn't fit the world at all, and is in fact potentially enormously damaging.
Okay, now, so we're coming back to why we've got a bunch of academics, and then we've got these models being set forth that are that are involved in this water footprint, I mean, and they're very. I mean, I see them as convoluted, but, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of, maybe a lot of science and mathematics involved in it, but it gets pretty strange. And with the nitrogen and the water and the carbon, and our lives are going to be controlled by these things that somebody set in some think tank thinking this thing up, or a university.
Well, it's the concept of the models and mathematics applied to our world began back in the 1920s, 1930s. And people like Bertrand Russell, who was a mathematician and a philosopher, and a line of thought developed called logical positivism, and that is the idea that you can quantify everything, and that once you can quantify it, then you can predetermine it and control it and everything else. And, you know, it's the idea that a number in and of itself is a perfect thing. And of course, that's really underlines the whole concept of the computer model. This is a model that is really a mathematical, they're all mathematical models. And therefore, you put in numbers and it spits out numbers and they're pure and ideal in of themselves. And one of the things I watched with the climate area was when the climate modelers took over and started trying to model what is really a nonlinear system, that is, it is really not predictable. It created all the difficulties. But, of course, they tended to bully people and dominate because, I'm a mathematician. I've got all these numbers, and here's these formulas. And if you don't understand that, you're just an ordinary idiot. And where you see it in society in general, and I'll bring it into the climate issue, in the 30s, averages became the statistical measure of everything. You were looking for averages. Were you above or below average? So that you got the average weather, which, of course, was the climate. And of course, as... one person who wasn't a scientist, he said, you know, climate is what you expect, weather is what you get, which really summarizes it. But the concept of averages, so you went back in the 40s and so on, so what's the average weather at this particular place? That was the climate. And then from the 60s and 70s, it suddenly became trends. In what direction is the average moving? And of course, from 1940 to 1975, almost 1980, global temperature was going down, and it was, oh, that's the trend. And you can also think about this applied to society in general. You know, you saw graphs in the company, oh, the trend of our sales is up, and the trend of this and trend of that. And that became the dominant thing in society. Now what they're starting to realize, and something I've been yelling about for 15 years or more, is that it isn't just the average and it isn't just the trend, it's the variability about that average or trend. Now you see this in today's where they're saying, oh, there's more storms than ever. There's less rainfall than ever. There's more rainfall than ever. What they're really starting to talk about is the third segment of statistics, and that is variability or variation. And I'll give you a personal example of this. That a doctor called me, and the secretary called me, said the doctor wants to talk to you. And of course, you get in a panic. You think, oh, I got cancer or something. I go in there, and he said, oh no, you said your triglycerides are way above average. And he got very angry because I said, well, that's great. And he said, well, what do you mean that's great? And I said, well, I've been trying to be above average in something in my life, and if that's what it's got to be, that's fine. And he still didn't grasp what I was saying. And then I said, well, look, how many samples of my triglycerides have you taken? And he said, well, we got one. I said, if a student did a research paper for me and had one sample and drew a conclusion on the basis of it, I'd throw them out on my office. I said, if you'd show me that over a series of years my triglycerides were increasing, I might start to listen to you. And he still didn't understand what I was saying. And I said, look, what you're telling me is that I'm above average, so you've got an average figure for triglycerides amongst the population. And that because one reading's above average, therefore you think that I've got a problem. So I said, that's like an NBA player walking into your office and saying, my goodness, you're 7 feet tall. You're way above average. We got everything below the knees has got to go. We've got to cut you down to size.
Well, you know, this is one of the things that I've noticed when I was listening to these various experts on the global warming issue is they were studying different parts of it, and there's so many parts that it's almost impossible for anybody to put the whole thing together and make any sense out of it.
Yep. Okay, now think about that, Melody, in the arguments that I've made and you've heard me talk about, that when you stand outside, you're experiencing the weather. But that is what scientists call white noise. And white noise is made up of individual red noises. So the weather that you experience is the sum total of everything from cosmic radiation in deep space to heat coming off the bottom of the oceans and everything in between. And one of the things that I keep saying to people is, look, ask yourself, why have they picked on CO2? That's only one very, very minute part of an incredibly complex system. And that's something that we've talked about on this program. And the analogy is, of course, it's like you're standing outside of a football stadium and there's 100,000 people in there all making a noise. Well, the noise you hear is a white noise. It's the sum total of everybody in the stadium making a racket. But to identify any single noise in there one that's affecting all the others or having an impact, that's incredibly difficult to do. Yet that's what they're claiming they can do with the weather. That they've narrowed it down and said, no, it's the CO2, and all the other things are not important. In fact, the IPCC report, and this is the most incredible part of it, it says that up until 50 years ago, all the natural factors causing climate change were dominant. But in the last 50 years, human CO2 has swamped out all of them. It's an absolutely incredible thing to say, and yet they get away with it, and nobody challenges it. Well, I do, and of course, you know what happens to me. I'll tell you what, an analogy, it's like a doctor saying, look, I'm going to examine you. And then he says, well, look, to save time and money, because the insurance company are on my back, I'm only going to look at one wart on your left arm. And then they write a report to you, and you say, look, you are a small, brown, wrinkly person with a high potential for cancer. That's my analysis of you. That's how stupid the CO2 focus is. But that's what's been going on.
Yeah, but then they get these different. It's though they've all polarized, and one gets into one camp, and one gets into the other. And for anybody to step out of that arena is deadly, and I mean deadly at times.
Yes, but that's What that is you see, that's a reflection of it becoming a political issue rather than a science issue. And I'll give you an illustration of that in another way. When they started to argue what was called the consensus argument, oh, the majority of scientists agree. Well, consensus is not a scientific fact. It is significant in politics. If the majority agree, then that, you know, that's what democracy is all about. But that's not what science is about. As Einstein said, I can be right on 100 things. I've only got to be wrong on one, and the other 100 mean nothing. And so as soon as they started arguing the consensus argument, I knew that this had made it had become a totally political issue. And of course, then what polarized it was the funding. And the funding went to those that were, and of course, Maurice Strong deliberately set it up through the World Meteorological Organization, because that then gave him control over the weather offices in every country in the world, and that virtually all of the research funding on climate went through those weather agencies. And of course, they were only funding one side of the research. So that polarized it even more. And then you add to that, as I said, this general trend in society of, if you're not with me, you must be against me. And you've got a very unhealthy situation on your hands.
Right. And so when we tie this into resource control and yep. and many things that are necessary for life, and they start creating these whole... I mean, they haven't even unleashed what's going to be. I mean, this is where I'd like you to kind of explain a little bit on the water footprint and what that's all about. And,
okay.
But before I go there, let me just say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and I've got Dr. Tim Ball on the line here for the interview. And I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. So, okay, the water footprint.
Well, one of the things that I realized very quickly when I started studying climate was that the single most serious impact on flora and fauna, that is the plants and the animals, and of course that includes humans, are droughts. And in fact, in the year 2000, in a form of almost numerical alliteration, they asked 20 top climate experts to name the 20 worst disasters of the 20th century. So, and of course, what was interesting was 11 of the 20 that they listed were droughts. And when you look back in history, you see the impacts of the drought that destroyed whole civilizations. The Anasazi in the American Southwest is a very good illustration of that, and the Mayan and so on. And what was also interesting was that four of the top 20, the second largest group, were flooding. And it occurred to me that water was absolutely essential to understanding the whole planet. And I, almost tongue-in-cheek, started a campaign with my students of trying to get the name of the planet changed from Earth to water, because it's the one thing that distinguishes this planet from all the others. And where you see that pervasively is that whenever NASA goes anywhere looking for life in other places, what are they looking for but water? Now, that's an assumption they make, that water is necessary to life. It may not be. It could be hydrochloric acid or anything else, and that's the sort of underlying assumption that you make that restricts how you think about things and how you see things and how open-minded you are. For example, they said, "Oh, you need sunlight to have life on Earth," and then suddenly they find in these geothermal spouts on the bottom of the oceans, where absolute pitch dark, and here are these creatures that are living without sunlight and living off of sulfur in temperatures that would kill virtually anything else. But the idea about the water on the planet, and of course it also was important because water vapor is by far the most important greenhouse gas, and yet it was essentially being ignored. And so for all of these reasons, I got interested in water as an issue, and I started researching it and publishing a few things on it, and then started teaching a course in water resources. And that it was a course on the world's water resources. And, of course, we're talking primarily about fresh water. There is seawater, and it's the old ancient mariner's rhyme, but water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink, and desalination, some of these techniques. But it would primarily fresh water on a global scale and then a continental scale, and then particularly an interest in water in the North American context, because just as an illustration, and we can get back around to talking about this, the NAFTA agreement was virtually all about the water issue. And so I say we can talk about that a bit later. But getting in, and of course the conflicts over water that have gone on throughout history, how different societies have dealt with access to water. I mean, there are tribal groups in the Sahara Desert who have an order by which people get access to water when they find it, and in some instances the animals come before the humans, because without their animals to carry them or to feed them, they're really in trouble. So it's very, very interesting to look at water at the very basis of life. And so I said that led me on to being appointed to conflicts over water with the Manitoba Water Commission. It led me to being appointed to the chairman of the Assiniboine River Management Advisory Board, and that's a river that's in severe flooding right now, partly because it's a natural flooding event, but also because of humans attempting to control and interfere. And then you look at the flooding that's going on down the Mississippi right now, and again with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that have attempted to control that river. So the water issue, as I said, is going to be the resource issue of the 21st century. Just to give you one little example of it, by the way, Iraq, everybody's looking at the war and the conflict and so on, but what's got pushed aside was the destruction of the infrastructure in Iraq because of the war. But while the war was going on, the two major rivers that flow into Iraq, the Tigris and Euphrates, which of course are very important rivers in human history, the Fertile Crescent, Turkey built a dam on one of those, and Syria built a dam on another one. And that, of course, will reduce the flow of water into Iraq and ostensibly create water supply problems for the country of Iraq. And then you've got problems in Africa with when Sudan starts taking its share of the Nile River, the impact that'll have on Egypt, and so on and so forth. So you can look around the world and see the potential conflicts over water that exist.
Well, what it looks like on the surface then was some of the documents and meetings that were set up around this UN control of water was making it appear that they were coming in to make sure that that water was going to be provided to everybody, and that they had equal access to it. And this may have been what the NWAPA thing might have been about. I don't, you're probably more up on that one. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
I'll talk about the NWAPA in a minute. But the ideas about, well, first of all, the difference between water as a public good, that is that it's a resource that is essential to life, and therefore everybody should have access to it, the minimal amounts that you need for surviving as a human being. And of course, it has that very deep moral component to it that no other resource has. I think it was Patrick Moynihan, who said that you can live without love, but you can't live without water. And, of course, water has been a very big issue in the U.S. with the all the different water projects in each state and the handing out of money to those different water projects and various U.S. senators that have been involved in those things. But it's based around that idea that water is a public good and therefore must remain in public control. But on the other side, of course, is the concept of the privatization of water. And
These two are existing at the same time, and often they're in opposition of each other.
Oh, yes. But it was one of the things that brought Maggie Thatcher down was that she voted to privatize water. She let water companies set up and sell the water to the people, even though all the polls showed 86% or higher of the public were opposed to it. And of course, it's an issue that is very much at the heart of the whole debate that's going on around the world, and that is how much and what should be under government control and how much should be with private industry or private control. And I say water is very much at the heart of that, but has generally stayed in the public good as a public resource. And of course, one of the when you go back and look at the civilizations of the past that realized the value of the water, I mean, you've got civilizations in Southeast Asia, the Khmer civilization, and so on. But the one that's affected us the most has been the Romans. I mean, the water was at the very center of Roman life. In terms of you know, the baths and providing huge baths for the citizens, emperors made their names doing that. Caracalla, the emperor, built Roman baths in Rome. They estimate 25 acres of roof over them, just massive. And you could really plot the spread or the extent of the Roman Empire not only by the baths and hot baths and cold baths that they created, but also where they went to for lead mines to get lead for the piping that transported the water for them. And many of the terms that we have in today's society have come down from Roman water laws and use of water, so aqueducts and spigots and all of these other things. And indeed, the whole pricing of water. So, for example, you had an aqueduct, and a Roman citizen paid a certain amount of money to drill a hole in the side of the aqueduct, and the amount of water that you could get was based on what you paid, and the more you paid, the bigger the hole you could drill, and the lower down on the side of the aqueduct you could place it, so you got more pressure flow with your water. And when you look at, when you go to Rome, I mean, the most incredible aqueduct system that they set up, and sediment traps and just unbelievable stuff. At one point, over 300 miles of aqueducts bringing water into Rome. And, of course, they also had to deal with the other problems, that once you bring all this water in, how do you get rid of the surplus and the waste that goes with it? And the Romans built a sewer system called the Cloaca Maxima, which is still in use today. And but I say so much of what we got. Now, out of the Roman system, we got our law, our legal system, because the fundamental British law on water is riparian rights. Now, riparian, of course, means river in Latin. And the idea was that you didn't own the water, but you were responsible for the quality and quantity of the water that was on your property or moving through your property. And then you also had what was called prescriptive rights. That is, if your neighbor didn't have water, you had to provide access to the water for your neighbor. And you can go around cities and see where there are pathways down to the river so that people across the road could get access to that water. And in England, for example, the crown owned the first 35 feet along the edge of the river. So that whole riparian idea came from Rome, was built into the legal system, and was the first system in the U.S. Certainly all the eastern states adopted that system. Canada has the same system. But what happened was that as the U.S. expanded to the west, and then, of course, Horace Greeley said, go west, young man, and the further west they went looking for the land of milk and honey, the drier it got. And they get to California, and they say, well, you know, we got to get some water in here. And so you end up with massive water projects in California. But they changed the law in the U.S. Into what's called the appropriative doctrine or prior rights. And this is the idea that if you've got water on your property and you're the first to use it, then that gives you the right to the water. And it creates all kinds of interesting situations. But some of the states have both. They have riparian and appropriative doctrine or prior rights doctrine. Canada has riparian rights, and yet we've signed the NAFTA agreement with the U.S., which is primarily prior rights doctrine, which is totally different philosophies behind the legal systems of the two nations. The other one that's interesting is Australia, because it's 94% desert. It also adopted the prior rights approach that developed in the U.S. And so you can see, you start to understand so much about society is built around the water, the importance to water, the rights of access to water. And I say that it underlines the whole NAFTA agreement.
Okay, so from my understanding, when I was looking at some of the information on the water footprint, it's like if you grow an orange in some place, they were measuring how much water it goes from one place to another, and this is where your model thing comes in here. That's just totally absurd, as far as I can tell.
Yep.
And you take that orange from one place, and then you go take it to another place, and you got to account for all that water in between, even though it's an individual item. When it would probably the amount of water when they're doing it is this. It's kind of like measuring money that goes through. Everybody says they have that same dollar in their bank account, but it's really only so many dollars.
Well, and of course, you see, if you're going to have a model, then you've got to have numbers. You've got to be able to quantify, and that's where we come into the what I talked about earlier, the logical positivism. If you couldn't put a number on everything, then you can resolve the problem. But, of course, human society is more than numbers and quantification. I mean, just to give you an illustration of how bizarre this can get, people think, well, you got a number is a number. But there are different types of numbers, right? There are discrete and continuous numbers. So you can have a number that says, you know, there's three bananas on the table. That's a discrete number. But you could have a continuous number like it's 12:27 as a time. But you can keep breaking that down into more and more numbers. It's just 12:27 is a very imprecise. And that's a continuous number. And there are statistical models that what the result that you get out of the end of the model is determined by the type of data that you're putting in at the beginning. Now, of course, you look at it and say, well, I put the numbers in and I got a number out, so that's the answer. But it isn't at all. You've used completely the wrong type of number in that model. That's how sophisticated this can get and how complex it can get. And of course, when you start applying quantification to not only group behavior of people, but individual behavior of people. And this is why statistics became almost the death knell of psychology. I mean, psychology students now have to study statistics, and back in the 60s, because most art students weren't number-oriented, they created statistical packages for social science students, where you had a book and you got a formula and you plugged the numbers in and you got a result out. but you had no idea what you were doing. And so you saw it applied into categorizing people in sociology or psychology, and to me it just dehumanized everything, and I think is at the basis of so much of the problems that we've got in today's world.
Well, you've got a multi-layered system being put implemented and put into place that most people are not even cognizant of because it's such so wide reaching on so many levels that it those of us that are trying to look at it just swimming in information that it is just phenomenal because they have made it such so much minutia and a lot. I mean, sure, there's good information in there, but there's a lot of stuff in there that is just totally unnecessary. And I'm sure it's been done on purpose. It's just kind of like trying to go to the stock market and study it, and they've got quantified everything that, and much of it isn't even worth quantifying.
Exactly, and that's why Madoff was able to get away with what he got away with. And I mean, you watch the business channels on television, and they're talking about derivatives and all of these things. And it not only is it numbers, but they create their own language and terminology.
Right.
And in fact, if you think about it, when you go to university and the first year course you take introduces you to the terminology, the language of that particular specialty area.
Right.
And you can have one word that means one thing in one discipline or speciality, but something completely different in another speciality. And so, of course, part of this, Melody, is that information has always been power.
Mm-hmm.
But it was until, really, with the whole development in the U.S., was that the ordinary people said, no, we're not going to let those kings and those few rulers at the top have all of the power and all of the information. We want to democratize information and therefore democratize power. Now that of course has been going on in the U.S., but it has been stifled and blocked by passing laws and limiting access, and of course then you have to come along with Freedom of Information Acts to allow people access to the data and the transparency. It, of course, is one of the great benefits of the Internet is that this is the first time that you've had really democratization of information at all levels, the access to the information, and where in the old days some event would occur and only a few people at the top of the society that had access to that information and therefore could use it and so on. Now something happens and there's 2 million eyes or 2 billion eyes looking at it instantly.
Right.
Now we're just learning to come to grips with that. And of course what we're seeing is just how corrupt so much of this is and how these people have used that control of that information to control us.
Yeah, it's kind of, they're doing to information what they're doing to the dollar, right, you know, where they just, you know, thrown so much money out there that it's lost its real value. And the same thing happens with information. It gets to the point where you can't, you're weeding through so much stuff and, but it just didn't happen just now. This has been going on for a long time.
Oh, it's been going, but it's been exploding.
Right. And
certainly since the end of the Second World War, it really been exploding. But that idea about, as you said, of putting information. When I was in the Canadian military, they used to do exercises where they would take air crew and release them in a certain town and tell the local police that they were out looking for you and the military police and so on. And it was called escape and evasion. And the idea was if you got caught, they would sort of torture you. They'd tie you to a tree in the middle of a field in the dark of night and so on. And you had to only give name, rank, and serial number. That was what you gave. Didn't give anything else. And, of course, then they'd torture you and all the other things. While I was in the military, they abandoned that because they found that even though you were captured by your own people, a lot of guys were just saying, I'm afraid. I'm going to talk. So the policy became, look, if you're captured, just start talking and keep talking. just say whatever you want. Make up lies, tell anything you want. In other words, let the enemy sort out what the truth is and what the truth isn't. And that's, in a sense, what you're referring to now with the flood of information out there and trying to make some sense out of it all.
Okay, and when is they're trying to...
It's increasingly difficult.
Right, and as they're trying to destroy the current measurements in the monetary system, while they have these things like the water and all these other things, the carbon trading, these are other means that they're monetizing things that are all, that they can, they're made up. They're made up,
yes.
Just like money is.
Yep. Oh, sure. It's all just a big monopoly game. I mean, if the reality is looked at, civilization is come from cities. Cities only exist. And I made up a phrase a long time ago that I used in the farm community, and it says that there are no farms in the cities, but there are no cities without farms. And one of the great achievements of the U.S. people was to get to the point where 2% of the population that are listed on the census as farmers are feeding the other 98%. And not only that, but food left over to export and feed the other parts of the world. Now, that had never been achieved in history. But surplus food is surplus time. And in that surplus time, you can create any kind of a monopoly game that you want. And so, of course... the best form of monopoly game that we can see is democracy and openness and transparency and accountability. But of course, those megalomaniacs we talked about at the beginning of the program, those psychopaths, of course, they want to control, they want to limit. This is why, things like freedom of speech in the U.S. are so absolutely essential to making the monopoly game fair.
Right. Well, they have no intent of doing that. And when you were talking about, I was going to equate one of the things that I observed in, like, the insurance business from which I have a background in, is what I watched was a cycle that took place, that every few years they would come in and reinvent their policies so that it confused everybody, and they had to learn how to use it again. And by about the time they got to learn how to use their insurance, then they come out and reinvent it again.
Yep.
And so I see this is what they're doing with the carbon and the water and
and of course, if you can put value on those things, and this is why water, of course, becomes essential. And people are looking for things that are going to hold their value no matter what they do with the paper currency, and you see that, of course, in the gold.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't eat gold. And this is why the Mormons, I mean, what's his name, Glenn Beck, kept talking about, you should have a year's food supply in your house. Well, that's the Mormon idea. But as I pointed out to one of my Mormon friends, I know where the food is, and I got a gun. The food thing is at the heart of it. The water, of course, the value of that. But look at the this is an interesting aspect of the water and what we're talking about. In Canada, Canada's got about one third of the world's fresh water, and the price of water is ridiculously cheap. I mean, in the city of Winnipeg, where I lived for 36 years. Even when I left there, 1,000 gallons of water cost you $2.29. And when I was appointed to chair the Assiniboine River Commission, and the minister said, would you take the job? And I said, what I was thinking about doing was buying up the milk trucks that are now becoming available because of the NAFTA agreement, filling them with water in Winnipeg and hauling it to Phoenix, Arizona, where I could sell it for $2 a gallon. And boy, could I turn a profit. I could make more money than I could hauling gasoline down there.
Who else has that in mind?
And he laughed, and the next time I went to see him, he said, I've had three applications for people to do exactly what you suggested. But, of course, the thing was, as a provincial government, he couldn't approve that. Water moving across the international line is under federal control.
Okay.
But the price of water is is absolutely incredibly cheap. Even in Florida, where the average water bill can run to $300 a month.
Okay, but look at where they're going to do with it, like they've done with every other vegetable. Remember, you used to buy a bunch of vegetables, and it was measured in a much larger quantity. Now you're paying per vegetable, and those vegetables are pretty well equal around the board. Now, there's certain ways you can get around some of those prices, but as a rule, you're going to go in one place of the country, you're going to pay pretty close to the same that you're paying in another part of the country, because the middleman's involved there. And so the prices are going to be more equalized. And the problem is that the large amounts of water is going to go to the highest bidder, and it isn't going to be the average citizen.
And I can give you an example of something I was involved in with that. A very good friend of mine, and I'm pleased to say that because he was a former student, became a financial investment expert. Kind of followed the Warren Buffett line, and his philosophy was, I don't necessarily want to make money, I just don't want to lose any. And he got an invite to a conference on water that was held in Cincinnati in 1990, the only people invited to it were people that had over $1 billion to invest. And he said that the people that were at the conference, who's sitting at the table but Coca-Cola and Snapple? And why were Coca-Cola there? Because they were looking to buy up water rights, because they were starting to get into their own brand of bottled water, the Dasani brand. And the Dasani bottled water initially was just another choice in the Coke machine. Now you've got your whole machine is full of bottled water of Dasani brand. And, of course, what they were doing was buying up water rights. And so there's a perfect example of going in with, if you've got the money to buy the rights on it. But there are lots of examples like this we can look at. But of course, what we're really talking about, Melody, is that, the difference between a free market and one in which the government attempts to interfere or to equalize or to make fair. And of course, the minute that the government steps in with anything, it immediately distorts natural forces. And this is why, you got people like Milton Friedman and the real free market people. The irony of it is, of course, that the only time there's ever been a true free market in the 20th century was under communism in Russia. The black market was the only true free market. And of course, the government, because that free market was providing over 50% of all of the vegetables and fruits and needs of the people, the government turned a blind eye to it.
Well, it gets to the point where there isn't a. It's kind of like our choice in political candidates is which one don't you want?
Exactly. Well, of course, that's another thing I fought for, by the way, is that when you have the ballot, you should have the names, and then there should be a category for none of the above.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, people could tick it off, and then you'd get an actual measure of how fed up people are with the choices. As it is now, you can say, well, we got spoiled ballots or whatever, but that really is not an indication, whereas if it was a definitive vote of none of the above, you'd get an indication of that. And, of course, with that, you'd also get a lot of people that say, well, I'm not even bothered going out to vote because I don't want any of them. Well, if you could say, well, look, you can go and tell us that, they might go.
Well, so behind the scenes that's going on, right, from what I can tell, is you've got all these different groups meeting together and how they're going to – the same people that control the world in one aspect are also going to put their names at the top of the pyramid in their new governmental or economies or whatever they want to use for terminology and how they want to find out the shifting of the power and the resources and money. But the main guys are still going to be at the top of the list. And what they're going to start putting the squeeze on is the little guy, because they don't value the little guy anymore.
Well, okay. I've studied civilizations, rises and falls of different civilizations. I'm a great fan of Arnold Toynbee, the British historian who studied them, and one of the things that intrigued me was that civilizations generally grow and build to a peak and then decline over about a 300-year cycle. And the key thing is that you're always going to have, because we're back now to the Darwin, the nature and survival of the fittest and so on, you're always going to have those people that are natural leaders. And one of the interesting jobs I had when I was in the Air Force was flying VIP, very important people, around. And I can honestly say that there were a lot of them I didn't like, but you knew the minute you met them why they were where they were. There was a sense about them, an aura about them, and so on. But the key thing is the people understand that. But the key thing is that as long as those leaders understand that despite all their talents and abilities, they are at the top at the will of the people. And, when Pompeii erupted, or Vesuvius erupted and buried Pompeii, there was an election, there's been elections, and there was graffiti on the wall in Pompeii that said, if we get rid of this bunch of scoundrels, we just get another bunch of scoundrels. Well, people have always understood that. But the key thing is, for the people, do those leaders understand that? That they only are at the top at our tolerance. And if they don't, so when you got to like the in France, for example, there was always the hostility between the aristocrats and the peasants and so on. But it wasn't until Louis came along and said, l'état c'est moi, I am the state, and everybody nodded and said, yeah, okay, Louis, and then he said, and that's the way it should be, boop, I'll chop his head off. And I remember an incident in England a few years ago when Edward Heath was the prime minister, and on the Robin Day show, I said, well, is it true that despite all of the democracy and free votes and all the rest of it, that 90% of the wealth is still controlled by 10% of the people? He said, yeah, that's true. And then he said, and that's the way it should be. Well, the phone melted off the wall, and he had to go back on the next day, or he had to go on and apologize. His party said to him, you better back off on that. And so people will tolerate incredibly bad government because they know that it really isn't going to improve much with the new people. But the key thing is, and this is critical, by the way, because I think this is where Obama's going to have huge problems in the election, is the food, the food prices. For example, all the things that went on in Egypt, that was triggered by a dramatic increase in food prices. And that part of it got downplayed. It was always they're looking for democracy and they're getting out from underneath these tyrants and so on. No, the real trigger was the increased cost of the food. And those fundamental things, what I call universal truths, simply don't change. It's a matter of understanding them and then putting the historical events in those contexts. And that's why I'm saying what made America great was its ability to produce massive amounts of surplus food, which then gave it the power to do all the other things that it was doing.
But see, wasn't Maurice Strong's whole thing was to, the group that he runs with of world leaders, their whole idea was to control us with the food and the water, and it's now they're trying to make it a scarcity. They're using a whole psychology and PSYOPs campaign to get us to accept the higher prices and the scarcity.
Oh, yes. Yeah. This certainly the Club of Rome, and it starts with the Malthusian idea that the population will outgrow the food supply, and that therefore you better control the population and the resources that it's consuming. And what they argued was that that what aggravated the problem was that those nations that developed, and therefore the amount of materials and resources they needed to support them. Now that underlies, of course, the carbon footprint. But it also underlies the water footprint. That's why when you were talking about the orange and thing, And there was ridiculous tables come out. They said, oh, you know, a ton of steel takes 40,000 gallons of water. This is just pure theoretical nonsense. And it sort of somehow creates the idea that 40,000 gallons of water is in that ton of steel, and it disappears, it's gone. But the reality is, just as we're talking about with the nitrogen cycle, and there is the hydrogen cycle, the water cycle. That water is constantly moving through the Earth's system, and it evaporates off the oceans and goes up and is transported over the land, falls as rainfall, and it runs through the rivers and lakes back out to the oceans. And this constant hydrogen cycle, until we understand that and get accurate measures on that, we're vulnerable to all of these things about, oh, we're running out and we're this and we're that. And it's just an absolute scientific exploitation for control. I mean, if I look at Canada, for example, I say we've got about 30% of the world's fresh water. That's a very, very rough estimate, because for most of the rivers that we have virtually no flow data on them at all. We don't know what the volumes of the rivers are. And by the way, this is part of what NWAPA was all about. That NWAPA was the idea that the American idea that prior rights, so you've got that river and you're not using it, therefore you lose it. And so they looked at the river flowing from Canada into Alaska, and then they wanted to do the idea of the NWAPA is to divert that river south, down through what's called the Rocky Mountain Trench in British Columbia on the border with Alberta, create a huge lake, divert that water into the Columbia River, and then down through the Snake and into the Colorado, out to the American Southwest. Now, this idea was put forward by the Parsons Company out of Los Angeles back in 1952. And one of the great proponents of it was Senator Moss of Utah, because, of course, that's one of the dry states, one of the water deficit states. And so they saw this as a potential of using water that was not being used by anybody and therefore should be diverted south and create this great flow of water. Now, it had other aspects to it. There was a canal that was going to go out across the Canadian prairies and could be used for barging grain. And it was going to be used for power production, hydroelectric production, and so on. So it was a massive project, I thought it had died. But then there was an article in Scientific American that came out where there was concern about salt levels in the soils in California because of irrigation. And they're saying the only way that you could get rid of those salts is to flush them out with fresh water. And the only place you could get the volumes of fresh water needed to do that was through the NWAPA project. And by the way, NWAPA stands for the North American Water and Power Alliance, because I say there was these positive things of producing power as you were moving this water around. And the other thing, though, that's happened is that most parts of the connections for NWAPA are in place, certainly from the northwest of the U.S. down through to California. And in fact, in California, there's been quite an active move for a long time to separate Northern California, wants to separate from Southern California to recover and regain their water rights. Huh. And NWAPA's been around for a long time. It's gradually being put together piece by piece. And a few years ago, worked with a woman we produced a map showing all of the canals and connections and dams and diversions. And of course, the Colorado River is a major, major part of that scheme.
Well, you know what I would envision, you know. They could still be doing that, but what if they were doing it in the ground as opposed to on the surface? And that, to me, would make more sense because of the evaporation and the like. Now, unless there's something, a factor I'm not aware of here, but they were doing something like that in Libya. And and Libya may not be just about what we're being told it is. There may be a whole other aspect around this water issue.
The country to look at in terms of, well, I talked about the Roman situation, and there's a lot we can learn by looking at the Roman situation. Of course, the Romans also had an advantage that when they started to have difficulty with water and people stealing water and tapping into the emperor appointed a water commissioner. And I've often thought that if I was to change my name, I'd love to have his name. His name was Sextus Frontinus. I love that. But he became the first sort of water czar, if you want, in ancient Rome. But it got to the point where the emperor decreed who could have water rights and access to the aqueduct and so on. Now, of course, we don't have that kind of totalitarian control at the moment. Israel is the nation that's in the forefront. It's the only nation that I know of that has a national water policy. And in Israel, you can do all the planning and all the development you want, but the final approval on it must be from the National Water Commission group. They're the ones that have the final say. Now, of course, Israel start with the assumption that any water that's coming from Lebanon or Syria is unreliable supply. So they really start with Lake Tiberias, as the Romans called it, or the Sea of Galilee, as it's in the Bible, or Lake Kinneret is another name for it. And of course, out of that flows the Jordan River down into the Dead Sea. And they have effectively diverted that river into what's called the National Water Carrier. This is a huge pipe running down the west side of Israel. But the point I'm leading up to is to your point about underground water. Now, underground water in geological terms are called aquifers. That is, it's a porous rock in which you can a lot of water can be stored. And as opposed to aquicludes, which are rocks like granite, which are basically impervious to water. And aquifers, of course, there's some very large ones. But in Israel, what they do is that they store water in the aquifers. So during the winter, when they've got an excess supply of water, they will pump that water into the ground and use the aquifer to store the water.
Do they use a tunnel piping system like Libya?
No, it's just simply injected into the ground. Because you can then recover it by pumping. It's just, you know, the other thing they do with it, by the way, is they also pump down partially treated sewage. Because if you take water and pass it through, 50 feet or 100 feet of sand, it comes out pure at the other end. And that use of aquifers for storing water is really, Israel's been in the forefront of that. They do that in the Negev Desert in the southern part of Israel. Now, in Libya that you mentioned, some of the largest aquifers in the world, two of the largest, are under the Sahara Desert, which is a great sort of paradox almost. But that water was put there during the last ice age, because when you had ice caps over Europe and half of North America, the desert regions became much, much wetter. So the Sahara Desert became grasslands and forest. And now we refer to those climatologically as when it's very wet in the desert regions, that's a pluvial. And again, there's that Latin, pluvial is for rain. And then as it is now, when you've got the desert there, that's an interpluvial. In the further north, you've got the glacial epoch when the ice is there, or the interglacial, as we are now, when there is very little ice. So right now in the Sahara Desert, they're in an interpluvial. But during 20,000 years ago, there was a lot of rainfall in the desert, and these aquifers were formed. Now, what's important about an aquifer, and when you drill a well, you're drilling down into that aquifer. You're going down to the water table, which is the upper surface of that water in the ground, and you tap into it. Now, you can pump water out of that well, but you can only pump it out at the rate at which the water moves through the rock. That's called the recharge rate. If you pump the water out quicker than that, then the well will go dry. And now it will eventually flow back in. But the rate of movement of water through the ground varies tremendously around the world. I mean, you could have as much as 200 feet per second. But in the Sahara, the recharge rate or the movement of the water through the ground in most areas is about 2 inches a year. Now, Gaddafi, of course, wanted to develop the desert, make the desert bloom. And so he set out on this plan to start, he put huge pumps in to start pumping this water out of the ground. And I think it's a measure of Gaddafi that when they had a big conference and they invited the press from around the world to what they were doing, and one of the reporters said to him, well, Mr. Gaddafi, at the rate you're pumping the water, it'll be all gone in 30 years. And Gaddafi's response was, so will I. So, you know, sort of an intellectual honesty in that.
Okay, but, so then you're saying then this whole system that they built and whatever is, you know, maybe using up a resource that won't be there to, you know, recharge and sustain.
It's like any resource. You can take so much, the sort of the annual surplus, if you want. It's like if you have a lake, you can say, well, look, I've got all that water in the lake. But the actual water that's really only available to you is the surplus each year. If you start taking out more water than is flowing into the lake, mm-hmm. of course, what will happen is the lake gradually disappears. And that was a proposal. I was at a conference in 1985 in Toronto, and there was a proposal to use the Lake Superior, take water out of Lake Superior, because they wanted to build nuclear power plants all around the lake because it was remote and safe up there. Because, you know, forgot about the Canadians across the border, but nonetheless. And then it pointed out to these people, well, look, at that rate that you want to take the water out to run your nuclear power plants, the steam and all the rest of it, the lake will be gone in about 50 years. And so you can only take so much out of anything. Otherwise, you know, it's like with your savings account. You can only take out what the amount that it grows. Otherwise, right. You're cutting into the basic resource.
So I guess the reason why I was going in this direction is just trying to think like some of these guys are, and they're kind of greedy. And they kind of like to not, you know, kind of like to control everything. And I would figure that if they wanted to pump water around, that putting it in the ground and being able to do it in a system that they could control and that they didn't lose it through evaporation and send it just about anywhere would make as much or more sense to me than trying to do it through a river system or above ground canals.
Yep. Oh, no, absolutely. No, and as I said, the use of the aquifers to store the water. But you see, one of the things that's interesting is you have all sorts of laws about surface rights, land rights, water rights on the surface, but very few laws in most parts of the world on who owns the groundwater, who owns the mineral rights underneath the land. And of course, this is one of the things a lot of the oil companies do. They buy up the rights to what's underneath the land. I was on a dog and pony show around Alberta a few years ago trying to warn the farmers, saying, look, the government are passing laws that say you only own the top, I think it was 15 inches of the soil. Everything below that is belongs to the government or whoever wants to pay for it. And I remember a drought in Coronation, Alberta, and they called me out there to talk to them about what was going on because a farmer had gone to dig what they call a dugout to try and get some groundwater in and get water for his cattle, and the government show up and say, hey, you don't own that. You can only dig it 15 inches deep, and the rest is not your land anymore. And there's so many things that unless you know the rules, unless you know the regulations, and of course that's what a lot of these people are very good at. They either learn the law and know how to exploit it, or they will pass the law that suits what they want to do.
When I was observing some of the meetings around here with Nestle, and they were doing a presentation, And you know, the person had come in and been here for several years, and I think he came here just to kind of get a feel for the community and had, you know, whatever he had to do to get this all rolling. When I saw the presentation, the first thing that I realized was, you know, he keeps showing this big recharge area that he's not even buying with the spring, but he's showing this area that's big and massive, and yet he's talking about a spring. And I'm going, they've got their sights on a whole lot more than just the spring, or he wouldn't be showing that. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but
no.
I was looking at that, and I'm going, and this is at this one, you know, confluence between, you know, headwaters and you know, then there's geothermal off in another direction, and I'm going,
yep.
Is there a monopoly or chess game going on here that I'm just kind of watching go into place?
Yep. Yes. If you have a suspicion, 9 times out of 10, it's a legitimate suspicion. But you see, one of the things that we talked about the recharge rate, but there's also what they call the recharge area. So you can have an aquifer in one area, but the place where the water is being put into it could be 50, 100, even further away, miles away. For example, in Australia, you have springs in central Australia. The most famous one is Alice Springs in the center of the continent. Well, the recharge, the water that's put into the ground that comes up in the center of Australia goes in on the coast in the Snowy Mountain Range on the east coast of Australia, and it's hundreds of miles away. So you can have a drought on that east coast, and then quite a long time later, it shows up with a lack of flow in those wells in central Australia. And but this is again, you know, we're just learning about the surface of our world. And just to give you an illustration, all of Canada wasn't mapped until, well into the 1980s. I remember flying search and rescue in the Arctic over Baffin Island, and look at a map, and a big chunk of it says Terra Incognita. you feel like Christopher Columbus out there.
Uh-huh.
But then when it comes to mapping what's underneath the ground and then how much water there is and how it moves, I mean, one of the things that happened in the 80s was that the biggest aquifer, by the way, in the U.S. is the Ogallala Aquifer, which runs down the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains from the Canadian border right down into Texas, into the Gulf of Mexico. And there was articles in National Geographic and all these things about the irrigators were pumping out too much water, and the aquifer was, you know, the water table was dropping, and so on. Maybe in one or two areas there was a possibility that they were pumping out the water that caused what's called a cone of depression around their wells. But the major reason for the decline of the water table was that they were in a drought. And the 88-89 drought across southwestern U.S. was worse in climate terms, weather terms, than the 1930s drought.
Okay, now...
Now, since then, of course, the 90s, the rains came back and the aquifers recharged itself.
Now, one of the things that I've noticed that they've started, that I'm observing going on is, you know, and I think happened around the Denver area at one point, and I don't, you know, I'm not familiar with the whole circumstances around it, but taking place with, like, fracking, is they're pumping fluids into the ground. And part of the problem when they pump fluids into the ground, then it can make the earth shift. Are they working? I mean, it's coming down to a real science here,
right.
and pros and cons with it, the usage of this sort of technology?
Well, two issues there. Mm-hmm. One is that the idea of if you pump oil, you will recover, if you're, you know, a good system, you'll get one barrel in four. But if you can push something down, and in the early days it was sort of a brackish water, that is a slightly salty water, you could recover maybe two and a half barrels in four. But if you push CO2 down, you could recover 3 barrels in 4. And, of course, that idea of carbon sequestration
I can see where it goes.
Sorry?
I said, I can see where this one goes.
So, oh, yeah. but, of course, the beauty of it is that if you can get the taxpayers to pay, because the oil companies benefit from it, but it's a very expensive process. And so to get the taxpayers to pay is beautiful. But and of course, it's an irony because the CO2 is not a problem anyway. But the idea of injecting water into the ground and causing an increase in earth movement, that was discovered in the Denver area. I can't give you a specific.
I think it was in the 60s or something.
Yes. Yeah. Well, what happened there was that it was part of the agreement to get rid of chemical warfare weapons. And of course, in those days, the idea was that the solution to pollution is dilution. And that meant that if you could just simply mix enough water in with stuff, you would reduce the pollution level of it by diluting it. And to some extent, there's some logic in that. But they had to get rid of large amounts of gas, of poisonous gases. Mustard gases was one I remember. And so the U.S. Army drilled deep into the ground in the Denver area and started pumping this in the ground. A professor noticed an increase in what they call micro tremors. These are small earthquakes, and just one of those sort of serendipitous things. Realized because he got the data on when they were pumping the water down and when the micro tremors were occurring. Now that was discussed at that time as a possibility to trigger a lot of small earthquakes to then prevent big earthquakes occurring. And so there was a whole lot of debate back in the Reagan era about if they carried this out, could they then get the San Andreas Fault moving and then prevent the massive earthquake in San Francisco? The question that was asked of the Reagan administration was, you know, if we do this and a big earthquake occurs, are we legally liable? And of course the idea was never pursued that I'm aware of. But that of course is now becoming one of the issues with this. The fracking, as you said, and but the idea of pumping water into the ground has been going on for a long, long time to increase the oil flow. Just the new twist on it is the CO2. But they started pumping CO2 into the ground in Texas, I believe it was in the 70s. It's been around for quite a while. But here's another thing: they didn't do any of the testing on the potential impact of that until they started about a year ago in Australia. They got a project going in Australia to test what impact this would have on the groundwater, because of course the CO2 is absorbed by water, and what it does then is create a carbonic acid. And at what level does that become a problem? What is that doing to the groundwater? Of course, a lot of people are not aware of this, but all rainfall is acid rain. All snowfall is acid rain, because as the water droplets fall through the air, they absorb CO2. So rainwater is about a 10% carbonic acid solution. That's one of the reasons, by the way, why rainfall is more effective on plants than water that you take out of the tap where the CO2 has escaped from it. And people always say, oh, the rain is so much more effective. Well, that's the reason. But as I said, in terms of the impact of this in the groundwater, and in Alberta, where I've talked about earlier with the droughts, you know, we had the situation where the farmers were not allowed to get water for their cattle, but then they learned that the oil companies had permission to pump this water into the ground, and they were pumping good potable water. And so you can imagine the conflict that created. There's a whole, you know, what we've learned about the world on the surface is still very, very limited, but underground was even much less knowledge.
Okay, now we can run over if you want, and if you had time, and I mean, I'm still, there's a lot of questions I still have, but if you okay. if you need to go now, we can also do that. So
No, I'm fine, Melanie. Yeah. I'm flattered that you want to still hear what I have to say.
So, well, let me go ahead and say this is KATNLP 106.9 Salida, and I've got Dr. Tim Ball with me as my guest this evening, and we're kind of jumping around a bit, but the whole idea is looking at how water and weather, and I mean, there's some other aspects I want to ask him that all tie into this in weird ways, but they all do tie in, and one of them is I was just hearing a discussion about how radiation is involved in creating or can create weather events. Is that true, or did I state it right?
Well, the idea about energy propagated through the atmosphere and wave energy and radiation energy, I mentioned at the beginning that the 21st century is going to be about water and magnetism. And, of course, magnetism is a natural force that we know has an effect upon the weather, not just the Earth's magnetism, but the sun's magnetism as well. And, of course, Einstein, after he'd published his theory of relativity, spent the rest of his life trying to come up with what's called a unified field theory. This is the idea that all of these forces of magnetism, gravity, and electricity are all interrelated and interconnected, and that there's got to be a grand theory, the unified field theory, that brings them together. The idea about radiation affecting the weather, that began after the war, and it goes back to another problem, and that was the difficulty that the Germans had communicating with their U-boats, the submarines, out in the oceans. And, of course, when they're down at periscope depth, yeah, they could put up an antenna and pick up some signals, but it was a huge problem. And, of course, we're before satellites and everything else. And so they started experimenting with ultra-low frequency and other, you know, very, very low frequency radiation of power, but it needs enormous power. And the signal, of course, goes around the Earth. It doesn't have to go straight line. But the problem with it is it interferes with all other forms of radiation and energy. Now, there was an agreement between the wars that nations would no longer do this using these ultra-low frequencies, extremely low frequencies and so on, because of its what it did to all other forms of radiation. And so it was abandoned. Now, after the war, of course, a lot of the problem of communication...
Hey, let me, just a second.
Yeah.
It affected. How is it affecting? Am I missing something here? How did it the ultra low frequency? What was it increasing it? What was it creating?
Yeah, you're just you need massive amounts of energy to push out this huge waves of energy out through the atmosphere. Now, part of it, part of this was that I guess it's all connected to communication. But there was an interim period between the these extremely low frequencies for transmitting around the world, getting around the curvature of the Earth was the problem. Now, they had an interim phase of what was called high frequency, HF, and that was done by bouncing your radio signal off of the F layer in the ionosphere. And, of course, the F layer in the ionosphere became then the focus of an awful lot of research. One of the terms that you've heard people talking about began with this, and that was the HARP project, High Altitude Research Project. And in this, they were firing rockets up, Churchill, Manitoba was one of the places where this was being done. And of course, what they were trying to determine was, could they predict and could they measure and getting accurate transmission of radio signals in particular around the world. And of course, anybody that was involved with ham radio knew all about this. But they also knew, of course, that the ionosphere and the F layer were seriously affected by outputs of energy from the sun. And that's another part of this issue of magnetism and radiation and so on. Now, the problem was solved to some extent by the satellites going up. And particularly once they were able to put up what are called geostationary satellites. Now, geostationary satellites are a satellite that you put up at about 22,000 miles above the surface of the Earth, and it moves around the Earth at the same speed as the Earth is rotating. So in other words, it's directly over one spot on the surface of the Earth, and it stays over that spot because it's rotating at the same speed. You only needed three of these satellites to cover the whole globe. And that solved some of the problem for them because, of course, now the Soviets could have their satellites up there and communicate with their submarine fleet, which by during the Cold War got up to 700 submarines. Now, most of them were World War II submarines, but nonetheless, they had a lot of them out there. And their problem with the Soviets was that once their submarines were out away from Russia, they were essentially isolated because they had to come out of Murmansk in the north, and it was easy to monitor them. And I know a lot about this because I was flying anti-submarine patrols for the Canadian Air Force over the Atlantic, and I was involved in the Cuban crisis when all the Russian submarines popped up to the surface and ran to the nearest place where they could get their supplies recharged. But anyway, the geostationary satellites solved the problem, but then they started developing satellites that could destroy other satellites in the same way that you had the different types of submarines. You had submarines that could carry intercontinental ballistic missiles. You had hunter-killer submarines, that is, attack submarines that simply sought out and destroyed other submarines. Well, they just developed the ability to destroy other satellites, and then, so this created a problem, because you say, well, okay, we have a war, and then immediately our satellites are gone, and we've lost contact with our troops around the world. And if you think with the U.S., with the different fleets, the Sixth Fleet, the Mediterranean Fleet, and all the rest of it. And so all of a sudden, and it was noticed in Scandinavia, that Scandinavian radio and television was being absolutely swamped by massive energy forces of radiation coming from the Soviet Union. And that's when story came out that, they're trying to affect the weather, there's weather warfare going on here. But in fact, what they were doing was developing these ultra-low frequency things again in order to, if they had to, have an ability to communicate with their forces around the world. But as I said, it morphed into radiation being used to control or direct the weather. But if you think about the energies involved, when you think about the amount of energy that's within a single thunderstorm, for example, I mean, it's just absolutely massive. And the idea that you could influence with radiation from the ground, the amount of energy that you need to do it, it's just simply not possible.
So you don't really think that they really would be using it so much to create or the weather control or
no sort of, okay. No now having said that, I'm not saying that they're not playing with all kinds of things. these people, we're absolute geniuses at producing weapons of war and weapons of destruction and everything else. I wish we'd divert it to more productive things, because, of course, the Industrial Revolution was preceded by an agricultural revolution. Having been in the military and knowing what went on in terms of electronics and electronic countermeasures, as they were called, and that's another thing we could talk about sometime, is all of the listening devices under the ocean. For example, very few people know that there are microphones set on the continental shelves all around North America that are listening and monitoring ship and submarine movements. And of course, the use of sound with sonar, we used to drop what they call practice depth bombs, just a little charge that would explode underwater, and then we could pick up that sound directly from the explosion, but then also from it bouncing off a submarine. So it was sort of an echolocation of submarines. I've always worried about that because, of course, when you start the amount of noise that's created under the surface for creatures like dolphins and whales that are so sensitive and use sound for migration and location and communication. And sound can be transmitted over huge distances. I remember one time we were told that we could identify the signature of engines by the sound, and we were told that there was a Russian submarine off the east coast of Canada, Nova Scotia. They sent us out to look for it, and we couldn't find it. It turned out that it was a Russian freighter leaving Liverpool, England, across the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, and here they were picking it up on these microphones on the east coast of Canada. So it gives you an idea of, you know, but really what we're talking about here, Melody, is there is so much that is going on that most people don't know about, but there is also far more that we don't know about the Earth and the way it works and the way nature works.
Okay, so I don't know. I'm just I wish I knew more about what I just listened to today about this radiation thing and how it may be a natural form of radiation too. But if you had a natural and you had a not so natural, could they not be used? I mean, could the not so natural be used in a way that, you know, the natural can create snow or rain? That's what it was in reference to. Does that make sense?
Okay, one of the things, and I'll put this in the context of the natural, one of the things that we've known for a very long time is that in order for a raindrop to form, you have to have condensation occur in the atmosphere. And the normal way that that occurs is that the air temperature drops or cools down to what's called the condensation dew point. And at that point, the water vapor, which is water as a gas, will condense onto a solid. And those solids in the atmosphere are called condensation nuclei. They are very minute particles, microscopic particles, floating in the atmosphere. Most of them are either salt particles or they are what's called kaolinite, which is the smallest particles of clay that you can have. And, of course, they're blown up off the surface of the Earth into the atmosphere. If you don't have enough of those nuclei, condensation nuclei, then the water vapor will not condense into a water droplet. All right? Now, water droplets are incredibly small. In fact, you need about a million of them to get together to form a single raindrop. But the cloud that you see is made up of those water droplets. Now, there's another problem in getting all those water droplets together to form a raindrop so that it'll fall to the ground as rain. So the actual process of rain is very, very complicated. Now, this is why, of course, that cloud seeding is what you're doing is you're dropping into the cloud these condensation nuclei that attract the water, cause more water droplets to form, more water vapor as a gas to condense onto them, and hopefully it does enough so that that you will then get rain out of that cloud. And what we've never been able to figure out up until about 1990, a little bit later, was that there were not enough nuclei in the atmosphere for all the cloud that we had. And so if you start talking about interfering, if you want, but by cloud seeding, then you're causing more water droplets to form and therefore more rain. Now, this was done to increase rainfall. There were several examples of it done in the U.S. The Russians were experimenting with it a great deal, the Soviets. But it also was used to prevent hail. So that if you could drop nuclei into the cloud, the thunderstorm, and make it rain before the hail could form in the cloud, then it became known as hail suppression. It was the same process. The difficulty with it is you couldn't measure how successful you were because you didn't know how much it would have rained if you hadn't seeded the cloud. Okay? Now, starting in 1991, Svensmark and Christensen and Larsen started to study the idea that cosmic radiation from space was entering the Earth's atmosphere and coming down into the lower atmosphere and forming condensation nuclei. And that was then determining the amount of low cloud cover that we had on the planet. This became known as the cosmic theory, and a very good book on it called The Chilling Stars, that people want to read about it. And we've known, just to connect again, we've known for a long time that there was a very direct correlation between the number of sunspots and the temperature on Earth. But we never knew what the mechanism was. And, of course, in science, you can have a correlation between things, but it's very dangerous to assume that there's a cause and effect between them. And, of course, one of the favorite that I like is the argument that the guy said that Diet Coke causes obesity. And he said, my proof is that more obese people drink Diet Coke than any other group of people. Therefore, clearly, that's the cause. Well, we knew that there were, as the sunspot numbers increased, the temperature of the Earth went up. As it decreased, the temperature of the Earth went down. But we didn't know what the mechanism was. Well, it turns out that when the sunspot numbers vary, the magnetic field of the sun varies in strength. And as the magnetic field of the sun varied, it was almost like a filter determining how much cosmic radiation was getting to the Earth. And so, of course, that was what was going on. The cloud cover, the low cloud cover, then was acting like almost putting a screen in the greenhouse. And that was the mechanism by which the correlation between sunspots and the temperature were varying. And so it's another one of those examples where you've got this cosmic radiation and the magnetism, which we talked about earlier, creating a phenomenon that suddenly explains something that we had these troubling relationships, but we couldn't pin them down. Now, what's interesting is that this cosmic radiation theory of Svensmark's, as I said, it's been in the literature since 1991. It's still not included in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports. They mentioned it in the 2001 report in passing, but it gets no mention in the 2007 report. And yet it's very clearly an important mechanism in affecting the climate around the world, and it integrates radiation, cosmic particles, magnetic fields, and other things.
Okay, now, let me see if I'm following you. Okay, so if you have cosmic radiation, or if you had something like Fukushima, and you were releasing large amounts of radiation into the atmosphere, would it be creating rain and various things from its release, just like, causing this precipitation, like could be happening from the cosmic radiation?
No, the cosmic rays from space are a particular
a type of
okay. particle, and that they it doesn't it only creates low cloud, by the way. The only way that you could get more condensation nuclei from the ground level is by putting up the particles. You know, silver iodide was one of the ones they used for cloud seeding. I'm not aware. I suppose it could be done, but I'm not aware of any research or even discussion about using that kind of cosmic radiation from the ground up.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that they'd be using it. Would it be a kind of a field effect from it, possibly? I mean, and one of the things that was brought on, and I can't remember if it was Hutchison or who had that, or maybe it was something that Andrew Johnson was talking about in a discussion. I don't know if it was around the Hutchison effect, but
right.
how it affects the radiation levels that you could possibly diminish or increase it through a field effect when you did a work with the electromagnetic energy around.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Okay.
I mean, you know, our knowledge about radiation and its effect in the atmosphere, I mean, one of the things we've got to remember is that the sun is a huge hydrogen bomb, and, of course, nuclear bombs put out radiation of all sorts across the whole spectrum. From solid particles, and we call that the solar wind, to alpha, beta particles, and of course, nuclear radiation, which can destroy organisms and life and so on. Ultraviolet radiation has an impact on DNA, and of course, that's interacting with the oxygen in the upper atmosphere and creating the ozone layer. So, yeah, there are so many of these things that we know so little about, but theoretically, there's a lot of things that could be done or used to have an impact.
Okay.
And then, of course, there's one of the great changes in human history is this from inadvertent modification of weather and climate and the nature to deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the great changes that's gone on in the last 100 years.
And I mean, I know this is kind of a little bit of an offshoot from it, but the Fukushima thing are you following this?
Yes.
And
from the explosion.
I mean, I'm so confused over
yeah.
all the different types of radiation and the ways that they measure it, that I can't make hide nor tail of what's being put out there.
Right, and this is one of the issues. Of course, when we mentioned the book that we produced, the Slaying the Dragon book, one of the issues is the argument that the greenhouse effect is due to different radiations and the ability of the gases in the atmosphere to trap that radiation. And what some of these physicists that have written chapters in our book are saying is, you know, that the way they've argued that in the climate science just simply doesn't work in the laws of physics. And so radiation and energies is a very, very new area. We've got some ideas about it, but, I mean, for example, just to sort of almost a flippant comment about it, but Einstein said there's no such thing as coincidence. He said, you know, that our brains have the ability to detect and be aware of things that we don't even know about. And therefore, that's what coincidence is. It's just that we don't know the mechanism and so on. And so he's really speaking to that idea about our knowledge about nature and forces and you know, the whole, not just the whole cosmos, but what's actually happening within our Earth system.
Well, I guess what are you observing as far as how we're being worldwide being affected by what's going on in Japan or the what's going on around those people with this?
Okay. The Japanese situation, and of course part of the difficulty is that the mainstream media are just, they can't wait for somebody to be announced that they died from radiation poisoning from the the damage that was done there. In fact, there's a couple of things about it. One is that they should never have built a nuclear power station at that point,
right.
Because earthquakes occur where you get different tectonic movement, plates coming together and get subduction zones, and that's probably one of the worst places in the world you could put one. And then, of course, the potential for the tsunami, it wasn't just that it was the nuclear plant itself was in danger, but the knocking out of the power that kept that plant operating and cool and so on. And in fact, what's amazing is for a plant that has been there for a long time and really, really should have been shut down and replaced and upgraded, whatever, it's amazing how little damage has been done. But people forget that, back in the 50s when they were exploding nuclear devices in the atmosphere and so on, what happened with any of that? I remember talking to a physicist who was working with the Canadian government on the impacts of atmospheric nuclear explosions, and he didn't even know that the atmosphere, the thickness of the atmosphere, was twice as deep over the equator as it was at the poles. And I said, well, how could you possibly do any studies on what impact that's having? The whole idea about radiation and transmission of energy through space is we're very limited in our knowledge about it all.
And so you don't see any correlation to what might could be going on with those people or the effects, around the world that would tie into what maybe happened with Chernobyl or...
No. In fact, if you look at Chernobyl, the number of people, the UN report, 57 people died. And in fact, one of the things that was interesting was that a lot of the cancer rates in the immediate area went down because, of course, we use radiation for treatment of cancer. And Three Mile Island, of course, nobody died. But these things are sensationalized. And, of course, the idea of radiation and nuclear, it really grips people. People are afraid of it. The dropping of the bombs in the Second World War. But you see, it's interesting. You could say, well, that shouldn't have happened. It's terrible. But even the Japanese commentator saying if the Americans hadn't have done that and brought the leaders to their senses, a lot more people would have died of starvation in Japan. And so when you start to look at the numbers and the realities of what's going on, I remember back in the late 80s and 90s, they were talking about radon, and this is another form of radiation that's naturally in the atmosphere. And then they were saying, your kitchen cabinets have got radon in them and emanating from them and so on. Well, you could go and sit on granite for a day and you'd get more radon than you could ever get from any kitchen living there your whole life.
Hmm.
And what we really need to understand is something that Paracelsus, the great chemist of the 16th century, said, that the toxicity is in the dosage. And Rasputin understood this. I mean, he knew they were going to feed him some arsenic, so he just started taking arsenic and developed a tolerance for it. So when they gave him a dosage that would have killed anybody else, he just swallowed it down and kept on going. And of course, it just terrified them. They eventually he died of lead poisoning. Of course, a nice little lead bullet dealt with him. But we really need to get away from the exploitation of fear and sensationalism. Now, that's not to say that there aren't pollution, that there aren't problems going on, but when you actually look at them in calmly and away from the glare of fear and sensationalism, so many of them simply are well within normal and natural events. And that's certainly happening with the weather events. You know, I mean, they're talking about this flooding on the Mississippi right now. And then you suddenly find out, well, it still hasn't reached the level of flooding that occurred in 1937. Now, how can that then be connected to global warming? And when you look at what the conditions were through the Mississippi Valley, the snow levels across the whole of the Missouri-Mississippi system, and then the prolonged winter and the late melt, and then because of the cold air, the storm system sitting through there with the tornadoes and so on, and that's actually due to cooling, not warming. And then when you look at the fact that the U.S. government declared the Mississippi a strategic river, which then allowed them to give control of it to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and of course they've been trying to control that river, but you can control it up to a certain level, but nature has, and we're back to that variation thing again. You know, if you work on averages, and then you suddenly get the variability increases, and suddenly the dike that you built for a 1 in 100 year or 1 in 200 year flood, and suddenly you get a 1 in 300 year flood because they occur, you've got a bigger problem, because once the water gets outside the dike, the water can't get back into the river. And these are some of the problems that we're creating for ourselves.
Okay, what about when you had so many tornadoes within that short period of time? Is that, I mean, I know that can probably occur naturally, but if they have weather modification programs, or if there's potential, I mean, there are those that feel that the American people, I mean, that there's warfare going on against the American people. Now, whether that's legitimate or not is, but you hear this going on. And yep. Sometimes you have to wonder when you definitely see it going on economically. And then you have the Navy, you know, on both coasts being able to do all kinds of warfare type drills for 5 years. You have to wonder what's going on here, you know.
Yeah, there's no question that, the concept of conspiracy theories, and I mean, I've been on the Alex Jones show, there's conspiracy theories everywhere, and certainly conspiracies occur. I mean, my birthday is November 5th, and that's called Guy Fawkes Day, and Guy Fawkes was, of course,
V-Day, or
yeah,
V?
Yeah, right? Well, the funny thing about that is that in Britain they say he's the only man that ever went to Parliament with good intentions. but also, and maybe this explains my bizarre behavior, is my mother always said the whole of England was celebrating my birthday. So I'm still learning to cope with that. But there are conspiracies. There are also what are called cabals. A cabal is a small group of people who get together and plot and have a particular political agenda that they want to push on people. And one of the problems that we have, and certainly I'm finding, is people can't believe that such a small group were able to control climate science and push this, and in fact, what they changed the whole climate record. I mean, the hockey stick was they rewrote history, and people can't believe that small groups can do that and get away with it. But we're back to that information is power, mm-hmm. And of course, if you exploit two things, one is fear, and you exploit lack of understanding. And Michael Crichton wrote about that so brilliantly in that book, State of Fear. Where he showed how these environmental groups operate and pick a particular natural phenomenon. And so when you start to talk about the number of tornadoes and the number of hurricanes and so on, I know when I look at the real numbers, that that what's going on is not outside of normal variability and normal patterns. I mean, just to give you an example, the worst year for a loss of life up until this year was 1905.
Hmm.
254 people died from tornadoes in that year. And of course, at that time, there weren't that many people living in Tornado Alley. And so, as I said, it's very easy for these people to take these things out of context because they know people don't know the record. They know people are afraid and say, oh, yeah. This. And then, of course, you can exploit the conspiracy theories ideas very, very easily. And I tried to do this, Melody. I was summoned to appear before the Canadian Parliament on the ozone issue. You see, there's another one that's come and gone. I realized that these people didn't understand how science works. And science works by speculation. They call it hypothesis. So they sit in their universities and they dream up all these things that are potentially threatening and potentially this and potentially that. And then normally what would happen is that they would go out to try and get the data to prove their theory or hypothesis, but other scientists would challenge it. Well, what's happened with the climate issue is that the hypothesis was put out there, and then anybody that dared to question it was immediately branded a skeptic and paid by the oil companies and all these other things. So what you ended up with was, as Richard Lindzen said at MIT, he said that the consensus was reached before the research had even begun. And what we're into is...
So you're seeing where the legitimate questions are going through the same kind of scrutiny, non-scrutiny, that the non-legitimate ones
yep.
are.
Okay. Yep. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, what I said with that ozone committee, the parliamentary committee I appeared before, I dropped my speech that I was going to give, and because the scientist next to me presented before I did, and here he's showing all these computer generated, and there's that thing again, computer generated models, and he said, oh, here's the level of ozone over Toronto in 1996 and the lowest levels. And I'm sitting there saying, but we've got no measures of ozone over Toronto in that year. And then, of course, what he was doing was presenting computer generated things and presenting as if it was real data. And I knew the politicians didn't understand that, and I did something I hope I never have to do again in my career. I had to interrupt him, and I said, I hope you people realize this is not real data. This is computer-generated data. And one of the things that's been going on with the climate stuff is that you've got computer models producing data, which is then put as real data into another computer model. That's how incestuous this has become. Okay, and so what I said to that parliamentary committee was, look, you need to understand how science works. Science is about speculation. And I said, I'm going to give you some facts, and I'm going to speculate about impending doom on the basis of those facts. The facts are that the Earth is slowing down in its speed of rotation. The facts are that the Earth's magnetic field has been weakening for about 1,000 years. The facts are that if it continues to weaken at the current rate, there'll be no magnetic field in about 150 years from now. The facts are that in the historic record, when the Earth's magnetic field disappears, as it does during magnetic reversals, there's massive extinction of species on the planet. And I want to know what my government's planning to do about this. Well, of course, they went berserk. He said, oh, we're here to talk about ozone. I said, look, I can stand here all day and pick out a few scientific facts and speculate about the potential doom from it. And that's what scientists do. And that's what's happened with the ozone issue, and that's what they've done with the CO2 and climate issue. But unless you understand what they're doing and how they're doing it, the minute you dare to question it, you say, hey, I'm an expert on this. What's your experience? What do you know?
Okay, now,
and, of course, that's one of the problems.
Okay, when you posed that question, did you think that there's anything they could do about it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what was funny. First of all, one of the reactions was one of the nicest things ever said to me. One of the politicians said, "You know, Dr. Balls, Galileo would be ashamed of you." And I said, "You know, just to be mentioned in the same sentence as Galileo is the greatest compliment you can pay me. Plus, it indicates that you don't understand the role of Galileo in the history of science." He was questioning the prevailing wisdom, and that's what I'm doing. But yeah, your response to your question, one of the members of parliament, who I found out later had a BSc in biology, he understood what I was saying, but of course, unfortunately, he didn't want to pose it
in that atmosphere.
Yeah, exactly. So he said, "Well, Dr. Ball, what do you think we should do about this?" And I said, "Well, we should get a large government grant, take all Canadians down to the equator and run like hell in one direction, speed up the rotation of the Earth again." And of course they went berserk again. And I said, you know, but you see, it that's another interesting part of it. I mean, how many people know that the magnetic field of the Earth reverses itself quite regularly? That the North Pole flips over and becomes the South Pole, and during those periods of reversal, as I said, there are massive extinctions that occur. And
so we're running around worrying about all these insects and animals,
yep,
going extinct when,
right,
there's probably not a thing we could have done about it in the first place.
That's right. But let's talk about that, the extinction issue. We had a David Suzuki up here, an environmentalist, supposedly a geneticist, but he hasn't practiced it for 30 years. He's driving across Canada doing radio and TV things, flogging a book, same old story, but also pushing his thing. And he's telling people, oh, you know, there's three species every hour going extinct. Well, Patrick Moore, who was the founder of Greenpeace and then found out the Marxists had taken it over and quit, he's just got a book out on it, by the way, now about that. Hmm. But we were saying to him, well, name them. Which species? Where'd you get that information? Well, I can tell you where he got the information. There was a professor at Harvard sitting in his office, and here we go with the speculation again, and he said, okay, in 1 square mile of tropical rainforest, there are X number of species. Okay? And we're losing rainforest at the rate of, they're cutting it down, and therefore, out of that 1 square mile of rainforest, we lose, say, 10%. Therefore, that means we're losing 10% of the 4,000 species, which works out to 3 species an hour. And it's just so theoretically wrong and rubbish. First of all, we don't know what number of species there are in 1 square mile of rainforest. We're not cutting the rainforest down at the rate that he claimed, because the numbers that were used for the cutting of the rainforest turned out to be 80% wrong. They were numbers created by the World Bank that were trying to estimate what it was going to cost to replant the forest. And then, of course, the applying the number of species per square mile in the rainforest to the whole globe is also nonsense. The number of species in each square mile is vastly different. And but, of course, so he came up with this theoretical number of 3 per hour, and here's this guy going across Canada spouting this number as scientific fact. The truth is that we find more species every year than go extinct. And, you know, I mean, they just had an article. There was that bat that they found in Southeast Asia. There are more species found, everything. It's estimated, by the way, Melody, that we've only found and identified and named about 35% of all the species that are on the planet. And
we have no clue what.
No, no. But you see, again, somebody once said, you know, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. I taught a course, a basic, it was a physical geography course. It was half climate and half geology and geomorphology. And I used to tell the students, look, I'm going to call this course The Way the Earth Works. And it was a science credit for art students. And I said, you all need to know this stuff because your student, you're citizens of the earth, and you better understand how the earth works, because I guarantee you somebody's going to come along and exploit your ignorance of that. And the way I describe it is what these people do, and the politicians are very good at it, is they get you shaking so hard with fear that the money flies out of your pocket and they just gather it up. And of course Al Gore was a master at that with his carbon credits. But we come back again to what we know about the earth, and the little bit that we know contradicts almost all of the scares and fears. And of course what it means is that we end up not getting our priorities right in what we deal with.
Okay, now.
The issues that we need to confront. I'll give you an example, Melody. Mm-hmm. One of the more serious problems in the world is soil erosion.
Uh-huh.
And, if you look at Baghdad, for example, Baghdad is now about 200 miles inland. Well, 8,000 years ago, it was on the coast. Well, why has that happened? Well, because you started agriculture in the Tigris and Euphrates basin, the Fertile Crescent, and you started, as it got drier, you went to irrigation, and of course then you got soil erosion, and that went out to the ocean. The same thing, the Mississippi, the Delta, the rate it's growing with all the soil that's washing off of Middle America with agriculture. Now we're starting to deal with the problem. The soil erosion problem got identified. And they got into zero till and minimum till, and this was all done to reduce the rates of soil erosion. Now, on the Great Plains in the U.S., naturally you lose about 5 tons per acre per year of soil. That's a natural rate of loss by water erosion and wind erosion. With agriculture, that was pushing up to 10 and 12 tons per acre per year. But they've now, as I said, gone to zero till and minimum till to reduce that. But you've got parts of China where they're losing anything up to 700 tons per acre per year.
How could that be?
Well, because of the farming practices and the rainfall, when you get into rice paddies and all the rest of it, so you get massive rates of soil erosion.
Okay, now to go back to the subject on the why,
yep.
Why it's important on the water situation, and not just on the water footprint, but the fact is that right now there really is a concerted conspiracy, is all I'm going to say, of trying to control the world's water. And also trying to even get control of a lot of the land in ownership of it. And unless we're paying attention to this sort of thing, we're going to find we're not going to have access to, water may be cheap now, but they don't plan on keeping it that way.
That's right. Absolutely. And of course, it's much like, as I said, when I was doing that dog and pony show around Alberta, I was doing it because they were changing the Water Rights Act for the province. And I read that Water Rights Act, and I knew what they were planning to do. But as an individual, all I could do is simply go and tell the people. But it's the old problem that... who was it? Benjamin Franklin said, "You don't know the value of the water till the well runs dry." And so that concept, so these things. I mean, go and look at some of the stuff that's coming out now about the Obamacare, the health care thing. Now, whatever side of that issue you're on is not of no consequence to me. I know I live in Canada, and I got to tell you, I've been very happy with the health care system. But you can find horror stories, of course you can. But go and read the legislation that's written. It goes beyond health care. It goes into, what you can do, what you can't do.
It's all about them being in control of us, our bodies.
Exactly. Of course.
Right.
Of course. I'll tell you, there's an old schoolboy joke in England about the guy's up on the soapbox in Hyde Park Corner, and he's shouting, come the revolution and things will be fine. And come the revolution, we'll all wear shirts and ties. And the guy at the back says, "I don't want to wear a shirt and a tie." The guy says, "Come the revolution, you'll do what you're bloody well told." So it's and I've watched it. I've been involved in it. Commissions of inquiry that I've been involved in, and you start digging into how legislation is set up, and of course it's where things are controlled. One of the things that I love to do, because I also taught a course in political geography, and they wouldn't let me call it geopolitics because that had connotations of Germany and control. But I used to give out a constitution, a written constitution, and said, you know, the students, don't read this. Wow, wonderful constitution. Boy, that's superb. We should have one like that.
Yeah, it's
the Constitution of the Soviet Union.
I was wondering if that was where you were going in that direction.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like management. You know, you can have the best system in the world. A bad manager will make it fail. You can have the worst system, and a good manager will make it work. It's not the words. It's what you understand and how it's used. But if you put it in law, and you have the rule of law, which is, of course, what the U.S. is based on. The laws are passed, and as those farmers in Alberta found, by the time the drought hit, they suddenly realized how the changes of the law were completely against what their needs and what they wanted.
Right. So I guess ultimately it is to kind of pay attention to the fact that, you know, right now, all those the laws and the ownerships and the like are being changed, and I'm sure you're observing, you know, there's various parts of Canada and in the United States already being combined as like our military forces, and I could see very well happening with, I mean, that's the whole idea between the NAFTA agreements and these other treaties that they're going to combine the water and resources, right?
Yep. Well, let's look at the NAFTA in more detail, because we had, it is Mexico, Canada, and the U.S., but just between Canada and the U.S., we'll talk about that specifically. We already had 80% free trade before NAFTA was signed. And in fact, one of the great ironies of it is that there is more free trade between Canada and the U.S. than there is between Canadian provinces. And a lot of Canadians are not aware of that. So the question became, if we already had 80% free trade, what was left to negotiate? And the answer is the water. Now, how did the water come into it? Because people say, well, the water is not mentioned in NAFTA. And my response to that is, it's the things they don't mention that you got to watch. Okay.
Right.
Now, how is it all about water? Well, the first thing you have to look at is who were the chief negotiators for the NAFTA between Canada and the U.S. Well, in Canada, it was a guy by the name of Simon Reisman, spelled R-E-I-S-M-A-N, and Reisman. His history was that he had gone around saying, I can guarantee free trade with the U.S. if we provide them access to our water. Okay. He also worked as a consultant for a company called the Grand Canal Company. Now, the Grand Canal Company was a scheme to put a dam across James Bay where it enters Hudson Bay. It's salty water, but it's a very low salt content relative to the oceans because of all the fresh water flowing into it. And the idea is that you then pump the water out, and then it fills up with fresh water from the major rivers that are flowing into James Bay, like the Albany and the Great Whale River and so on. And then you pump that water from James Bay into Lake Huron and down through the Chicago River out to the American Midwest. And that scheme has been on the books for some time. And I say Simon Reisman worked as a consultant for them.
That didn't tie into NWAPA?
No. Mm-hmm. There are other major water diversion, continental water diversion schemes that are beyond NWAPA.
Okay.
The Grand Canal scheme is one of them.
And that tied into another, Maurice Strong, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Another one was the Cooper scheme, K-U-I-P-E-R, which was a scheme to divert water from Manitoba down through the Red River system into the U.S. And then another one on the west coast here was a water pipeline, freshwater pipeline from Alaska along the west coast down into California. Those are the major schemes that are inter-country on a continental basis. But Reisman, as I said, worked for the Grand Canal Company. On the American side, the negotiator at the table was a fellow by the name of Paul Morphy, spelled M-O-R-P-H-Y. Now, I think the Americans were smarter in this sense in that Morphy was just simply the negotiator at the table. And sadly, he died, a young man of a brain tumor, but he was at the table. But the difficulty with having your chief negotiator at the table is that whatever is said by that person is basically what, you know, your official position. Whereas with Morphy at the table, as simply the mouthpiece, he could go back and then deal with the actual chief negotiator, which was a gentleman by the name of Clayton Yeuter. And that's spelled Y-E-U-T-T-E-R. Now, Yeuter had been the Secretary of Agriculture under Ronald Reagan. And prior to becoming the chief negotiator for the NAFTA, he spent 3 years with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers studying and estimating how much fresh water there was in Canada. But more important, and remember we talked earlier about these people who write books and tell you what they are going to do and the doctoral theses and so on. Well, Yeuter's doctoral thesis was on the need for a continental water policy. So, you know, these were the two negotiators at the table. And I could almost say at that point, well, I rest my case on the fact that the NAFTA was all about water. Now, when you say, well, why isn't it mentioned specifically? Well, it is mentioned only in passing. But the mechanisms for the sale of water and the movement of water in the NAFTA were built in. Water is very rapidly becoming a commodity, that is, having a unit price. And, of course, in the NAFTA, any commodity must be sold at the same price on each side of the border. So that once water becomes a commodity, it then comes under the commodities ruling of the NAFTA. And so when you look at, say, the city of Winnipeg, I mentioned earlier about $2.29 for 1,000 gallons, well, then you've got to sell that water across the border into the U.S. at the same price. Now, these things apply, like in one of the things that infuriates me as a Canadian is that Americans are getting Canadian oil and their gasoline is cheaper than what I pay. But we got more oil and gas, particularly oil reserves, than virtually any country in the world. There's more oil in the Athabasca tar sands than in the whole of the Middle East combined. And so yet I'm paying, it's almost like I'm paying restaurant prices for food in my own home. But this is part of the NAFTA. And the other thing is that in the NAFTA, I don't think you will see diversion of rivers, as has gone on in some parts of the world for water supply, but you will see pipelines of water. Now, I know about that because I have done some small amounts of research on the climate and the effects on water pipelines and freezing and so on. And so pipelines, of course, are covered under bulk carrier. So the mechanisms for the transfer of water across the border from Canada to the U.S. are built into the NAFTA.
Okay, so would that tie into the utility corridors?
Sorry?
Would that tie into the, what they call utility corridors?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's we've carried on a nice long little conversation here, and we've covered a lot of subjects, and I've enjoyed it. And
yeah.
I hope we can do this again sometime. And, What?
Thank you, Melanie. Yeah. Well, there's so much else to talk about. I mean, we're just touching on things here.
Right. And so I want to thank you again for the information and being my guest this evening. And coming up next, we're going to have music. So thank you again, Dr. Ball.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay.